Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. And just a reminder for folks, if you haven't already turned off your cell phone, if you could please do that because, well, I just came from the bill signing for the Marine Reserves and we had a very loud cell phone go off right in the middle of the governor's speech. So we want to make sure we don't have that happening here. So we have a lot up on the agenda today, as you can see. We'll try to keep on schedule, so I'm just going to give folks a warning up front. If you have written testimony, please make sure and hand it to our committee staff, and then please just summarize your key points because we can all read. Hopefully that's something that, oops, somebody didn't turn their cell phone off, that we can do on our own, but we'd like to hear from you what some of the key points are for your presentation. With that, we have the Dean of Oregon State University College of Agricultural Sciences here to introduce himself and say a few words to kick off our committee, and then as you can see, we've got a pretty packed agenda, and welcome very much. Thank you very much for being here, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation, and I will be very brief. I know you do have a very full docket this afternoon. Appreciate the opportunity to meet and greet. I've been at Oregon State University for 22 years now. Been in the College of Ag Sciences that entire time. My research program has involved nitrogen transformations in the soils and waters. Before becoming Dean of the College of Ag Sciences, I was Dean of the University Honors College. And before that, I ran a department in the College of Ag Sciences. Just wanted to share that, of course, the College of Ag Sciences actually involves a broader mission than just agriculture. It includes agriculture, but also includes issues related to food, agriculture, and natural resources. And so I really do appreciate the opportunity to meet with you here today and look forward to working with you as we address issues relevant to natural resources management and protection. And with that, I ask if you have any questions for me or issues that you'd like me to be aware of.
Great, thank you. Any questions for the dean?
Nope. No.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming here and introducing yourself today. As you probably already know, since you've been at OSU for quite a while, we work very closely with OSU researchers. We actually have several folks from OSU on our agenda today, but we'll look forward to working with you even further in your new capacity.
Thank you, and I'll look forward to that as well.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, next we have up Margie Hoffman from the Governor's Office. She's going to provide a brief update on the 10-year Energy Action Plan. And Margie, I think this is the first time that you are before this committee in your new capacity, so you may want to reintroduce yourself with your new hat on.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. My name is Margie Hoffman. I'm the new energy policy advisor for Governor Kitzhaber, and I really appreciate the opportunity to update you on where we are with the 10-year energy plan. In the end of last year, the governor pulled together several different task forces to look at different components of the energy sector in the state of Oregon, including transportation. The task force put together recommendations in areas like energy efficiency, demand management, land use and siting policy, and transportation. Those were presented to the governor a little over 2 months ago, and it's been my job over the last 60 days to work internally and also with people, stakeholder organizations and people within the different agencies that will be helping us implement some of the policies that we're thinking about to look at what we want to do over the course of the next 10 years. The draft energy plan will come out on June 1st of this year, and there will be an opportunity for public comment before we finalize the plan. So look forward to working with the legislature, look forward to working with different agencies and stakeholders as we work through. The draft is really the start of the conversation, and then look forward to working with folks to finalize that document and then move forward, set in place a framework for how we think about energy policy over the next 10 years. I would like to take the opportunity also to talk about the areas in which we're focusing. We're focusing pretty heavily on energy efficiency and looking at what we can do to unlock deeper, harder to reach savings in the energy efficiency sector. We're looking at transmission infrastructure, water infrastructure, waste infrastructure. We're looking at aligning the state's land use goals with our energy goals and making sure that we can develop projects here in the state, but we also do so in a responsible manner that protects habitat, water, wildlife. And then we're looking at the transportation sector. How are people getting from where they are to where they need to go? What modes of transportation are available to them? How are we funding those modes of transportation? How are we funding that infrastructure? And what fuel are they using to power their vehicle? That's where we're focusing. So happy to take any questions. But again, thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you today.
Marty, can you provide an estimate about when you think the document will be final?
So I, Chair Dingfelder,
I should say final draft. Yeah.
Members of the committee, we have not set a date for that yet. Want to make sure that we have the opportunity to get this right, since it's going to be a 10-year energy plan document and a framework for how we look at energy policy over the next 10 years. So I think the next phase, we're putting together the initial draft. We'll have a policy framework for how we want to move forward, and then we'll start to engage, or continue to engage, I should say, stakeholders to help us put the meat on the bones and figure out how we're going to work in each of those areas to move forward to meet our goals. So yeah, we don't have a final date at this point in time.
Okay. Senator Prezanski.
So following up with the chair, my understanding is sometime in June we're supposed to get, I guess, what we're going to call the first rollout of the draft.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Prezanski, thank you for the question. Yes, on June 1st, I will be emailing you the draft 10-year energy plan.
Okay. And that's going to, looking online, our trustee, a staff assistant, helped me get ready for a meeting I had. And she said, oh, you got to look at the 10-year plan. So I saw that the various subgroups, the committees and all like that. Mm-hmm. So this will be a breakout of their proposals? And or is this going to be one that's folding everything together with kind of a broader concept?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Prezanski, this will incorporate some of the recommendations that were put forward by the task force, but what this is a frame document where we outline our goal for where we want to get in energy efficiency over the next 10 years, where we want to get in terms of infrastructure and in terms of transportation, and then it will go through and set a framework for how we're going to think about meeting those goals, and in cases where we have fully developed and fleshed out policies, we'll make recommendations about how, what kind of policies we'll need to put in place in order to help us meet those goals. So the task force recommendations were great, but this document will really lay out what's the goal, and then look forward to working with people to help flesh out how we actually meet those goals.
Great. Thank you for putting that on the record, because I know a lot of people are wondering what to expect.
Absolutely.
Questions?
Yes. Yeah. Congratulations on your new position, by the way. Are you going to diverge greatly or slightly from the current addendums that are out now on the energy plan?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, thank you for the question. I'm so sorry.
We are brothers.
I was going to say from another place.
We're brothers by different mothers.
I'm not even going to touch that one.
Senator,
you're on your own on that one.
For the record, we planned that prior to the hearing so that you all would have something to laugh at. Thank you for your question. The document, again, it takes a step back and says what's the goal, and I think that wasn't part of the task force recommendations that were put forward. So we want to take it back and look at what's the goal, and then to the extent that the recommendations that were put forward help us meet that goal, then they will be incorporated as options for moving forward. But again, since this is a long-term 10-year document, we're mostly putting in place the framework of where we want to focus investment in energy and not tying ourselves to specific policies for how we want to get there. I think that requires broader stakeholder engagement and particularly help from the legislature.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Morgan? Okay. I have a feeling you'll be back in front of this committee possibly at the next hearing.
And a lot.
Yeah, quite a bit.
Wonderful to see all of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next up, we have an interesting topic to cover this. You're probably wondering, what is Arundo Donuts? And this came to my attention. I had some constituents that had some concern about a proposal that you're going to hear a little bit about. And so we've structured this group of folks to come and talk about an issue that is sort of at the forefront here with a proposal that you'll hear in just a minute from Portland General Electric. So we have a couple of panels. First, we're going to hear from Portland General Electric that's going to talk about why this is coming up and what they're proposing. We also have the, as you can see, the coordinator of the Oregon Invasive Species Council. We have the chair of the Weed Board. We're going to have on the phone, hopefully, Phil, are you there?
I am.
Okay, we have a very loud Phil Hamm, who's a plant pathologist out in Hermiston with Oregon State University. And then also we're going to hear from the Native Plant Society and the Nature Conservancy. So we are going to have Portland General Electric, Brendan McCarthy, come up and do an introduction. And for folks who don't know, Brendan has sorted history because he used to be the legislative. Yeah. He used to be the legislative drafter for this committee, so we go way back. But don't hold that against him.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. Well, the presentation gets loaded, and if it doesn't, we'll just use the paper version. I'm Brendan McCarthy. I'm a state government affairs specialist with Portland General Electric. PGE, as you know, serves 825,000 customers in the northern Willamette Valley. We span six counties, 52 cities. We represent about 43% of the total electric customers in the state, and the service territory of ours is responsible for generating about 70% of the GDP in the state. So we understand that electricity prices are important to our customers and indeed important to the economic engine of the state. So the presentation is looks like it's up. There it is. So you may recall that we were in front of your committee a couple of years ago talking about closing down Boardman. And indeed, by the end of 2020, we must cease burning coal at that facility. But it is a workhorse for us. It's 15% of our base load. We get about 380 megawatts out of it. We own 65% of the plant. And we're in the process of installing a suite of pollution controls to knock down sulfur emissions, nitrous oxide emissions, mercury emissions, and on a path to ceasing burning coal at the end of 2020. But because it's such a workhorse for us and it's a significant portion of our total fuel mix, we began to investigate whether there was an option to repurpose the facility. It is a relatively new facility as coal plants go. You find coal plants in this country going back to the 30s and 40s and 50s. This was built in 1980 and didn't run a whole lot in the 1980s because we had Trojan. And in fact, until we closed Trojan in 1992 or 3, I forget which, it was not idle, but it didn't run a lot. It's in the top quintile of efficiency for coal plants in the country. So it's an efficient plant. It's a relatively new plant. And it seems like a sustainable choice if we can reuse the facility in one way or another. I think I would be remiss if I didn't cover a little bit about where we are on our energy production and how we produce energy. This is our recently updated IRP plan with the PUC. We did this in January in front of the PUC. You can see our portfolio mixes on the right-hand side, where we are currently at the top, where we estimate we're going to be in 2015. Notice that large pie on the top part of the bottom pie chart, 43% natural gas. While gas is certainly cheap right now, it hasn't always been so. It's always been viewed as somewhat of a volatile fuel in terms of price, and that's a pretty big exposure in natural gas. So in terms of sort of getting your eggs in more than one basket, it would be great if we could diversify our fuel mix. And again, we'd begin to look at repurposing Boardman. A couple of things I want to note. People always ask us, what are you doing in terms of energy efficiency? We incorporate energy efficiency into our planning. You see 214 average megawatts planned. That's achieved through the ETO. We're also doing some interesting things to keep from having to build large baseload sources, including a fairly aggressive demand response program. That's 67 megawatts of additional standby generation. We have about 70 right now. Those are 0.5 to 1 megawatt engines that we can turn on and off that feed commercial and industrial sites. We control them. We fuel them. We can run them for up to 400 hours a year, and they help us shave the peaks. You also note that we plan to be physically compliant with the Renewable Energy Standard in 2015 through the addition of 101 average megawatts of renewables, probably wind, backed by gas. Two graphs I think are also important to see our energy picture, and I'll eventually get to the Arundo, I promise. You can see the tailing off in 2020. 21, that tail off represents the closure of Boardman if we don't shift it to renewables. But you can also see the red line. That's our load growth, expected load growth. You can see that we're a short utility, meaning we don't generate as much as we need. We have long-term contracts that are tailing off on the Mid-Sea, predominantly on hydro contracts. And we'll be adding our action plan acquisitions, but predominantly wind does not help our capacity graph on the right-hand side. We don't rely on wind to be there for us when we need it. So you see 775 megawatts of shortfall in 2021 on the energy side, and it's 1,280 megawatts shortfall on the capacity side. Is that clear? Okay.
Just to me.
Okay.
I'm with you.
So, again, back to Boardman. Can we reuse this plant? Can we repurpose it? Can we keep the jobs that are there? There's 110 full-time jobs at Boardman. I did some rough back-of-the-envelope calculations, and that comes out on an equivalent basis if you were to compare those jobs in Morrow County to jobs in Portland, and I know it's not a perfect comparison, but it comes out to something like 31,000 jobs in Portland. That's what 110 jobs are in Morrow County. So it's an important employer. And you know, the diversity that a biomass plant would add gives us some strong benefits in addition to adding a baseload renewable and helping us meet the renewable standard in 2020. My origination folks tell me, the engineers that do our energy planning tell me that 15% with variable resources is doable. Pushing to 20% is going to be difficult for them to integrate that much variable energy. So if we can provide a baseload renewable and help us meet the standard, that's a significant benefit. So we began to explore various biomass options. And we began to look at various crops that are grown around the country for energy crops. The one that came to the top was this Arundo donax. It is a grass. It's in the grass family. It's a very tall grass. It's grown worldwide, has worldwide distribution. It's been grown in the Mediterranean and in the Near East for thousands of years. It's been grown in the United States, probably dating back to as far as the 1500s when the Spaniards brought it over and planted it in California. We certainly know that it was planted in this country in the 1900s for stream bank retention. It grows very fast. It can grow to 25 feet tall. You can harvest it twice a year, and potentially has a production of 25 to 30 dry tons per acre, which is significant. If we're looking at a dedicated energy crop, we're going to need acreage to grow the crop, and the more productive the crop, the fewer acres we need. We think that it uses about the same amount of water as other commodity crops that are grown in the Boardman area, about as much as corn, about as much as alfalfa, and probably comparable to nitrogen inputs as well. Once we roast it, dry it out, it becomes crispy and can be used in a pulverized coal plant. That's the key here. We need to reuse the plant as it is. It's not susceptible to be converted to a natural gas plant. It's not susceptible to using green biomass. It's a pulverized coal plant. And whatever fuel we end up using in it, it needs to act and look a whole lot like coal. This plant and others like it can be torrefied, is the technical term, and then pulverized in our crushers and sent right into the boiler. Torrefied, it has an energy component that's about 1,500 BTUs per pound more than the coal we currently use. So you have an efficient plant, and you're adding more efficient energy source into it, and that's a win-win. It's not the only plant we're looking at. We're looking at other sources of agricultural material that are in the area. We will try anything that works chemically in that facility. If people come to us with wood pellets of some kind, we'll test them. Wheat straw, pea hay, juniper, you name it, we'll put it into the torrefaction process and see whether it works chemically or not. But again, we went through a showstoppers analysis with a lot of crops that were out there, and Arundo came to the top. It does have problems, and I'm sure you'll hear about that later beyond me. But a lot of the showstoppers we felt that existed with other crops didn't exist with Arundo. So it's invasive, and I'll say it first. And specifically in Texas and California, where it's invaded in waterways, where it was planted intentionally in waterways, the main way this plant spreads is by rhizome. This far north, it doesn't flower, and it doesn't seed. In places where it does seed, we found that the seeds are sterile. There was a study done of seeds in California where they tested 32,000 seeds. Five of them came up with enough, some, but not all, the proteins necessary for reproduction. So that was one of the showstoppers. Does it spread by seed? And the answer is no. It does spread by its nodes, and we've tested that in a greenhouse with help from Herrick. We tested 200 nodes and found that it was very difficult to get them to sprout at all. It doesn't grow in places where there's not much rainfall. In Boardman, the natural rainfall is 8 inches per year. That's not enough to sustain this plant naturally. So it's been grown for 7 years across the river in Prosser with research done by UW and Wazoo. And they have not had significant, or any that I know of, invasive issues with their test growing. But to be on the safe side and to be completely transparent, in our test grow, we're growing about 95 acres. We have a set of growing conditions with Morrow County that are the most restrictive that I know of in the country. I've called a number of other states where this is grown commercially, and I can tell you that limiting it to a quarter of a mile from any wetland or drainage ditch, keeping it out of the 100-year floodplain, those are significant restrictions that are not in evidence in other places it's grown commercially. We have a $1 million eradication bond to ensure that if it does escape, we will be there. We do physical checks around the field to make sure it's not escaping. And during the time period where we're growing this, and it's an R&D project, we're going to continue to test to test its invasiveness. We're engaged with the education community on this as well. We've brought in Oregon schools and Washington schools. We're looking at its carbon life cycle. We're looking at various, invasive qualities. We're looking with PSU at its volatile organic compound emissions. It does emit some terpenes, which are a component of haze. But we are investigating it, and that's the time period that needs to happen, is now. Just to give you a picture of what it looks like, this is our harvest from last year. Those are 1,200-pound bales. Boardman burns about 300 tons of coal per hour. If we're going to run this plant for about 6 months out of the year, we're going to need about 3 million green tons of material per year. Each one of those bales is 1,200 pounds, and that's about 3 seconds of burn time. Jeez. Just to give you a magnitude picture.
Can you repeat that?
1,200 pounds, yep. Green, about 3 seconds of burn time. So people ask us all the time for how many acres are you going to need? I think there's an outside chance at about 50,000. There's probably an outside chance at as much as 90,000. But the answer, real answer, is we don't know. If there are other agricultural wastes that we can use, obviously less. If there is another supply of something else, there's a sorghum that looks very positive and produces quite a lot, that could be the answer as well. And then finally, our timeline, and I think I'm on time here. We're shooting for a test burn in spring of 2014. It'll be a week-long test burn. It'll be 10% per day to season the boiler, and then with a 24-hour test burn at the end of it. At that point in time, we'll really know whether it works chemically in the plant or not. There are issues with silica with this plant. It could cause slagging in the boiler. There could be issues that we just don't know yet until we actually use it in the boiler. And after that, if it works chemically, we would be continuing to do additional co-firing, scaling up the production, and with the hope that in 2020 we'd be switching fuel. That's it. Thank you.
Well, we'll see if there's some questions. I have a few, but I'll see if the committee has any questions over here. Senator Thompson?
I have one. So are there any other projects looking at this in the whole rest of the world at this time?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, thank you for asking. We are being looked at around the world on this project, and I say that without too much pride. But it is being looked at, it's not too much to say that it's a game changer if it works out. I mean, there are other facilities in the world that are looking at co-firing with biomass. A lot of them are looking at green biomass. Some of them are looking at torrefaction. We issued our RFP for a torrefaction facility to 21 different interests. We got interest from about 12 of them. And two others that hadn't heard about it. So people around the world, and those are from around the world. We have interest from a company from Israel and across the United States. that are interested in torrefied biomass as a co-fire for coal facilities.
Questions? Senator Hass.
Thank you. I'm surprised Senator Pruzanski didn't ask if you've considered using hemp in that plant.
I was waiting. Timing is everything.
I do have a couple questions. What is the cost compared to coal on this, just generally?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Haas, we believe it will be cost competitive with wind backed by gas. So that's the future of our energy pie. And so that's the cost we're looking at.
Okay. And if I may, what is the protocol for approval to do this? Do you need PUC approval? And how?
Good question. Senator Dingfelder and Senator Haas, thank you for that question. That's something I did leave out of my presentation. We would be moving forward on this with full regulatory approval, both at the DEQ and the PUC. We would need approval for conversion from the PUC, and we would need new air permits for this facility. So it would go forward really using the guts of the plant, but it would be a newly permitted facility.
And finally, one more. I noticed in your chart that your percentage of hydropower is lower in the 2015. Is that because the supply is the same and demand is up, or what accounts for it?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Haas, it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of loss of hydro contracts and a little bit of that the pie is technically larger.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions, unless Senator Pruzanski wants to ask his hemp question.
It's timing's everything.
He's getting warmed up for that one. A couple of things that I know that there's a lot of unknowns here yet, but one that would be very important, well, two, is one is water, which you have down here in one of your slides, but you didn't really expand on that. The other is if you were planning to meet the need through growing Adirondacks, I'm assuming I think you mentioned you would be contracting out with farmers. So could you talk a little bit about that, one, what the water needs are compared to the more traditional crops that you talked about that you would be displacing, and then two, have you done an analysis to look at the potential, the opportunities for contracting, and I'm assuming you're looking within a certain radius of the plant to reduce your carbon footprint. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what the proposal is for meeting those needs.
Senator Dingfelder, thank you. The water question is an interesting one. We've tested both drip irrigation and standard pivot irrigation. The drip irrigation ended up taking about twice the amount of water and producing about one-tenth of the crop. Because of the sandy, loamy soils out there, the water ended up missing a lot of the rhizomes. So we're rejiggering that drip irrigation test. The circle irrigation, pivot irrigation, we're using about the same amount of water as alfalfa and corn. It's about 2.5 acre feet per year. The larger question you ask, I think, is we've always thought of this as displacing those commodity crops and giving farmers an option of a long-term fuel supply contract with us, thinking that that is a better economic choice for them than being subject to a year-to-year swing of something like commodity corn. So our thought was that we would be having, we would contract with farmers to grow it on existing acreage. It does not, and we do not think it can, compete with row crops or other high-value agricultural crops like potatoes out there is very important. We would like to investigate whether it can be grown in rotation with potatoes, and that's something we're going to investigate.
I was going to ask about a rotational crop. And then the other would be if you're going to look to add acres. And obviously you'd have to figure out the water issue on that because you'd have to be looking at some type of water rights that you – I'm assuming the plant doesn't have any water rights at this time associated with it.
Senator Dingfelder, the question of water rights in the plant is a complicated one that I'm not – going to get into. I think the answer to your question, however, is right now we are test growing 95 acres. We have a growing condition document with Morrow County that limits us to 300. And between
to how
to
many?
300.
Okay.
And between now and 2014, that's where we're going to be.
Okay. All right. I'm sure there's going to be lots of other information that comes up, and we may have some follow-up questions afterwards, but unless Senator Pruzanski wants to...
Timing's not quite there.
Okay, so well, we may call you back up at the end.
Well, what you have to do is wait for Senator Nelson to finally retire,
He was one of the co-sponsors of the hemp bill. He and his son are going to start growing industrial hemp. They'll have a direct line right into the pipe.
There you go.
Just ask that you give it to me first before we send it on to the torrefaction.
Thank you, Brendan. Okay, next up we have Lisa and the chair of the weed board, Bill Hansel, and then Phil. So is there a, do we want to have Phil go first or Lisa?
I think Lisa.
Yeah. And then is Bill Hansel here?
Bill?
Yep. Why don't you come on up? Lisa, do you want to introduce yourself? I don't know if this is all panel all together.
We can work together.
Yeah. Thank you for coming all the way out here.
For the record, my name is Lisa Deborah Kerr. I'm with the Oregon Invasive Species Council, and I'm their coordinator. I just have a very few brief comments to make. Just wanted to let you know, first of all, that our mission, as established by the Oregon legislature in 2001, is to keep invasive species out of the state of Oregon, and for those that get here, to raise awareness about them and enact control and eradication measures. The other thing I wanted to be clear about is that our role as a council is to work collaboratively with all of the other organizations and entities in the state of Oregon, and that very much has been the case on this issue. Our hats are off to PGE as well as all of the other entities that are working on this very important issue. It's a very complex one, and it's one that's driven by society's goals to convert from coal to some other renewable, sustainable option. We do support the development of renewable energy. We understand the economic benefits of biofuels, but at the same time, our council supports the use of native species, if at all possible, or non-indigenous species that don't exhibit invasive characteristics. And that shouldn't really be any surprise. The thing I think that concerns the council is the fact that there is a lack of information about this plant in the Pacific Northwest, and all of the entities that have been involved in this project to date readily acknowledge that. This is an incredibly invasive plant in the southern part of the United States and in warmer climates, where it is not native to those areas. There's lack of information about how this plant will perform in the Pacific Northwest when cultivated and transported at scales beyond what we're currently working at the plant, with the plant on. And as our climate warms, it's uncertain about how this plant will behave, especially when it's cultivated at larger scales. We're uncertain about the full scale of precautions that are necessary to prevent this plant from becoming invasive in the state if it does begin to spread, and we're uncertain about the protocols that need to be in place to adequately manage it. Of great importance and concern to us that there is a lack of resources at the state level to enforce protocols and precautions, long-term especially, and that recent risk assessments by the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Department of Agriculture have indicated that this species could be an A or B listed species for the state of Oregon. And for those of you that don't know, an A weed is one of known economic importance which occurs in the state in small enough infestations to make eradication or contamination containment possible. And so when we find an A plant in the state, there's an immediate early detection rapid response to eradicate that. So quickly, five recommendations that our council seeks to make is that we believe statewide regulations on Arundo should be proactively enacted. In other words, establish a control area for Arundo in Oregon. That pending further research, Arundo cultivation for production should only be allowed under the regulatory authority of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. They do have the expertise and management to deal with that, and that an adequately funded emergency bond be in place. And there is some question about what that amount should be based on how much it costs to eradicate this plant in other parts of the United States where it is not native. Specifically, we recommend switching to a per-acre assessment when and if the scope and scale of the existing Arundo production is exceeded. So in other words, when the prior gentleman mentioned going from 300 acres to perhaps 50,000 acres or 900,000 acres, when that scale begins to increase, that we may want to consider switching to a per-acre assessment to ensure that the funds are available should this plant exceed those containment areas. And that a fee-based system be implemented to adequately fund survey monitoring and eradication efforts. And as many of you know, the key to containing or preventing the spread of all invasive species is early detection and rapid response, and we can only do that through adequate monitoring and surveillance. And lastly, as a council, we encourage the Oregon Department of Agriculture to work with the nursery industry to explore options for phasing Arundo out of the nursery trade. So thank you for the opportunity to provide the council's perspective.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hansel, welcome. Thanks for coming out here today.
Thank you. My name is Bill Hansel. I'm a Umatilla County Commissioner and Chairman of the Oregon State Weed Board. The Oregon State Weed Board's statutory responsibility is to protect Oregon's economy, agriculture, and natural resources from invasive weeds. The Oregon State Weed Board has the responsibility under ORS 569.600-620 for setting priorities for noxious weed control in Oregon, which is in part done through establishing and maintaining a state noxious weed list. The Oregon Department of Agriculture Noxious Weed Control Program staff have done two plant pest risk assessments for Arundo donax, giant reed grass. These risk assessments were done using the best science-based information. The first risk assessment was completed in 2007, and the recommendation to the Oregon State Weed Board at that time was not to list, but to keep Arundo donax on a watch list. Arundo was reassessed in February 2011 in response to the proposed planting of Arundo to be used as a biofuel. The risk assessment showed that in the case of California, it was introduced by early Spanish settlers hundreds of years ago and was actually planted along riparian areas for erosion control. The ODA risk assessment for Arundo was reviewed by the USA APHIS PPQ and also assessed by them, which revealed that it will grow in about 55.9% of the USA. And I quote, however, just because Arundo will grow in most of Oregon, it does not mean it will become invasive there. Due to these and other factors, the Oregon State Weed Board has chosen to continue to keep Arundo on the watch list at this point in time, due to the fact that there is not conclusive evidence that it will become invasive in Oregon. Arundo has been sold in Oregon as an ornamental, planted for woodwind reed production for over two decades, and there are no documented wild populations of Arundo in Oregon. The Oregon State Weed Board and ODA are very sensitive to the fact of potential invasiveness of Arundo and have worked together with the Oregon Invasive Species Council, as was just mentioned, where we have held two joint meetings to discuss and gain as much information as possible about Arundo and potential for invasiveness, as well as the potential economic and environmental benefit of a green biofuel source that could be used in place of coal. ODA consulted with the Oregon State Weed Board and moved forward in establishing an emergency administrative rule for the test plantings to mitigate risk of spread of Arundo outside the fields. This includes, for example, requiring plantings are done no closer than a quarter of a mile from a water source such as a stream or river, and the proper cleaning of equipment. ODA has required a $1 million bond with PGE. These funds would become available if Arundo were to escape and there is a need for control of these sites, or to ensure that funds are available to control existing test fields if the project proves to be unsuccessful. The Oregon State Weed Board and ODA staff will continue to monitor the test fields very closely, and if additional valid information becomes available as to its invasiveness, another risk assessment will be done, and the board would reconsider listing Arundo donax as a noxious weed at that time. In addition, Morrill County, the location of the commercial test sites, has established a control area and conditions for cultivating Arundo donax in the county. The invasive side of the issue is being monitored and regulated at the present time. It may be interesting to note, as has been actually pointed out in previous testimony today, test plots have been grown in for nearly a decade at the WSU Experiment Station in Prosser, Washington, across the Columbia River from Morrill County. Their research did not identify any invasive problems. The plants do not produce seed. They were effectively controlled with glyphosate, or better known as Roundup. We do not know at this point if Arundel Donax can replace coal as a biofuel, but Oregon needs to determine through proper research in a safe, scientific, and environmentally sound manner whether or not this plant can be used for biofuel. The Oregon State Weed Board, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and Morrow County have implemented such safeguards while the research is being conducted. This concludes my testimony, and thank you for the opportunity to present it.
Thank you. We're going to hear from Phil Hamm first, and then I'll take questions if you can just stay up there because we have Phil on the phone. So, Phil, you want to go ahead with your presentation?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And thank you again for allowing me to participate via the phone. It allows me to be at a Hermiston City Council meeting tonight, which you just can't be in Salem and be here within the same time frame. I'm going to briefly talk about two different aspects of OSU's involvement with Giant Cane.
Phil, can you just state your name for the record and say who your affiliation is for the record, please?
Sorry about that. This is Phil Hamm. I'm the actually the director of the Hermiston Agricultural Research Extension Center with Oregon State University.
Great. Thank you.
So do you want me to start from the beginning again?
Yes, mm-hmm. Please. Okay. No. Just where you picked.
Sorry, I'm going to be reporting on two aspects of OSU's involvement with Giant Cane here in Morrow and Umatilla counties today, and hopefully I'll get through this very briefly. OSU's involvement, I think that, as was mentioned earlier today in your committee hearing, that when Dan Arp was testifying, that OSU is certainly has a statewide presence, and because of that, have the opportunity, therefore, to assist in very interesting opportunities, and this certainly is one. And so PGE approached us about 2 years ago to look at the agronomy issues related to growing giant cane in the Columbia Basin. This work continues to be in collaboration with them and is funded by them and involves OSU scientists not only at the Hermiston Agricultural Research and Extension Center, which is in Hermiston, along with the Columbia Basin Agricultural Research Center, which is in Pendleton. Of course, as I think most folks know, these scientists are highly qualified, and because of their knowledge of the area, the growing conditions, soil types, on and on and on, I think it was only reasonable that PGE approached us in their efforts to grow giant cane here. You wouldn't think that growing a weed would be difficult, but it turns out that just because when you turn it into a crop plant, weeds now no longer seem to grow really everywhere and not necessarily grow fast. So having an opportunity to look at these things in terms of agronomy issues is important, particularly when you make it into a crop. We know this has been mentioned already that from the California experience and other places, this has been a very invasive species. And because of that, it's also important, I believe, to have OSU scientists on the ground involved with this particular aspect of this of growing this plant. So some of the things that we specifically looked at, Oregon State University scientists specifically looked at related to this crop are as follows. But again, think of this invasive species as not the weed in your garden, because the weed in your garden, of course, is defined as a weed is a plant growing out of place. You suddenly make the weed into the crop plant, and now you need to know how to make it grow, how to grow it as economically and effective as possible, and of course have the highest yields possible. So it's really a kind of a turnabout when you think about this particular plant as a crop plant. Some of the things that OSU scientists looked at is how to plant these particular types of stems or tubers or plantlets or seed. How they're planted is certainly important, and I mentioned seed only because been mentioned already, and it's very important that as far as our work has shown and others have shown that seed is infertile and doesn't germinate. Certainly, if it does, at very, very low frequency, and we've not seen it here. What plant material, the plant relates to not only the size and of the plant itself, but when to plant it. Would it be better to plant it in the fall or spring to maximize the yield the following year? And those are kinds of the questions that are certainly important. How deep to plant the tubers or the plantlets or the stems and so forth, how to make the furrows. These are all basic questions, but since it's a new crop, you really don't know how to do those things until you look at them and determine which is the best way to do so. How, when, where to apply fertilizer to maximize growth, how much water is needed. It was mentioned earlier that about 2.5 feet of water, which is about the equivalent of alfalfa, that's certainly what is appears to be the case. How that water is applied, though, at what frequency and at what amount, certainly is questions, though, that still need to be answered. And, of course, how to control the weeds that are in the Arando crop. Remember, the crop now becomes Arando. Now you have other weeds that you need to control that would be competitive in the field, and those need to be developed. Herbicide usage need to be developed to control those weeds. And probably as important to all the other things that have already been mentioned by me is to investigate the aspect that this plant is an invasive species. And some of the work mentioned just a minute ago by me is related to looking at the potential plant parts to start plants in locations that are unwanted. And so OSU, both at Hermiston and in Pendleton, and folks from the main campus at OSU have worked with ODA and many others to help determine the actual risk to this plant to actually become an invasive species here in the Columbia Basin. Much of this work is being done at the field work and greenhouse work has been done at OSU here at the Hermiston Station, and I would certainly invite any of the committee members or anyone else in the audience that would be interested in giant cane to come and visit our plots anytime. We'd be happy to show you those. It appears, though, after a couple years of working this plant species, that this invasive plant isn't as invasive as we expected, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to be diligent, proactive to prevent escape as we learn more about this plant. And briefly, and secondly, I want to just say something about the Giant Cane Advisory Committee, which I facilitate. It was a brainchild of the Morrill County Commissioners. Their thought was to enlist a diverse group of folks that would help them develop rules that first made sense regarding the safety of Morrill County and beyond, but also the commissioners wanted to make every effort to establish rules that would prevent escape while ensuring that the rules were enforceable and biologically reasonable. And I would just tell you that the folks on the committee represent just a large group, soil water conservation districts in the area, ODA. We have growers on that, county commissioners, including Mr. Bill Hansel, who just testified, the weed control folks in Morrill and Umatilla counties, the planters there, the tribes, Nature Conservancy, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and OSU and PGE folks are adjunct members of that. We've met a couple times in the past. We've met face-to-face to meet each and everyone on the committee. We have been asked to by the Morrill County commissioners to specifically answer some questions regarding as they develop rules regarding the use and growing of and transport of Arando. We've also been asked by ODA to review the statewide rules that they were working on regarding Arando Domax, and I've also reported as a facilitator in front of the Oregon Weed Board and Oregon Invasive Species Board when they met at Boardman earlier this year, or I guess it was late last year. So there's a lot of things going on that OSU is involved with. We'll continue to work with PGE to help answer some of the questions, not only how to grow this particular crop, but also to help answer questions relating to how to keep it in check. And again, I just thank you a lot for allowing me to attend by video conference or phone conference, and I would certainly try to answer any questions. Okay.
Thank you, Phil. I just had a clarifying question, Phil. You talked about Morrill County having, I don't know if it's an ordinance, is it a temporary rule that Oregon Department of Agriculture has? Is it a local ordinance? Can you explain right now what the parameters are for, regulating the growing in the test plots right now?
Okay, I'll try to answer that question. I believe that Morrill County actually has an ordinance for growing Arando, not only growing but transporting Arando within Morrill County. The ODA, is my understanding, is working on rules that would be pertaining to the growing of Arando throughout the state of Oregon, but I don't believe that those have been enacted on at this point.
Okay. Well, as you were talking, Mr. Hansel just handed us the local ordinance that is in place, so I'll take a look at that. But so that's helpful. It wasn't clear if it was a state, the state that had established that, or the county, and sounds like the state is also involved, so we'll get some clarification there. So I'm going to open this up for questions to the rest of the committee members. Senator Thompson?
Yeah, this might be a question for Bill or Phil. Are the local farmers, have they had grower meetings about this? Are they excited about this? Are they fearful of it? Or what's the feeling of the farmers? Are they going to be willing to grow this?
Well, it turns out to be an easy question. It's all about money. Okay, so they're all capitalists. They will be looking at the corn or the potatoes or the alfalfa or the onions and so on and so forth that they currently grow and see how Arondo fits into that dollar-wise, and if it's economically feasible for them, they'll grow it.
Most of the agriculture in that area is on a crop rotation. Potatoes right now is the major cash crop, but you can't grow it back-to-back because of the nematodes that come into the soil. So you've got to rotate that out. This crop, I don't think it's going to be very good for rotation because it has the permanent rhizomes that come back each year. So it would require some changes in some of the agricultural patterns, but Phil's absolutely right that if it's economically feasible and viable and worthwhile, then we'll see the production acreage come into play.
Okay. Any other questions? Great. Thank you very much. I think we look forward to hearing as the test plots go forward, and I know we're going to hear some more testimony.
I might, in answer to the question mm-hmm. that you asked earlier, the Oregon Department of Agriculture came out with guidelines, with parameters for growing. Morrow County adopted those in a local ordinance because that's where the test plots are. We in Umatilla County, if we get test plots, will also adopt similar ordinances. At this point, we haven't needed to do that. The state's guidelines has expired. It's still out for comment. It's still out for discussion purposes. But we've kind of decided that the local governments have the authority to control it in their backyard, so that we've moved in that direction at this time.
Okay, great. Thank you for that clarification. We don't have Department of Agriculture coming up at this point, but we have them here to answer any questions if we need to. But thank you very much for making the trip out here today. And our last two presenters, we have Judy Sanders, who's with the Native Plant Society, and Kathy McDonald from the Nature Conservancy. Whoever wants to go first, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, committee members. I'm Judy Sanders from the Native Plant Society. I'm accompanied today by OSU Field Crops Extension Agent, retired Susan Aldridge Markham, also an NPSO member, NPSO Vice President and Legislative Chair Billy Don Robinson, and Nikki Wiseman, who is NPSO Youth Coordinator. I'm an Oregon native, but graduate school took me to Orange County, California, where in a 30-year period, I watched Arundo Donax invade the Santa Ana River, Carbon Canyon, and many other areas. Orange County, which has a land mass less than 1% of Oregon's, has spent $40 million over the past 15 years attempting to control it, and they are still fighting. I'm going to talk about four reasons why Arundo will be an invader in Oregon if we continue on the current path. Reason number one, existing scientific data show it to be invasive. The Global Invasive Species Database lists Arundo donax as one of the top 100 world invaders. DiTommaso et al. In 2012 indicate that the three strongest predictors of invasion are whether or not there's a climate match, whether it's invasive elsewhere, and the amount of it in the environment. USDA APHIS notes that there's a climate match, and you've already heard that. But it is also true that we had a feral patch in the Medford area that ODA had to eradicate. So clearly that's the case. APHIS also indicates that it is invasive elsewhere. In the United States, it is invasive from Northern California across the southwestern and the southeastern United States to Maryland. And they go on to note that it is naturalized as far north as South Bend, Indiana, and Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. In reference to the third criterion, when we plant 50,000 or 90,000 acres of this, or even far less, there will clearly be plenty of it to be invasive. Second reason it will be an invader has to do with how it propagates. Arundo propagates by rhizome or stem segment or layering. It only takes a small amount of the plant and water to regrow. But APHIS indicates that rhizomes buried as deep as 9.5 feet will regrow. So far, the seeds are sterile, but Glasser and Glick 2012 indicate that that can change, and they cite Townsend's cordgrass, which was a sterile hybrid for decades and then began to produce fertile plants, which would be catastrophic if Arundo did that. A third reason it will be invasive is it's a traveler. It stretches its roots. APHIS notes that in Texas, there are stands that are 0.5 mile wide. That means it can grow under roads, it can grow past irrigation lines, and it might be very hard to catch those feral plants. In addition, it moves by weather events. Now, winter flooding is unusual in Boardman, but the Morrow County Pre-Disaster Mitigation Plan notes that summer thunderstorms and floods, along with wind events, are risks in the area, and both of those could spread Arundo. APHIS also notes that humans track it, like in their clothing, in their boots. Machines move it, such as farm equipment, as well as the ancillary vehicles for people who work there, their trucks, and so forth. Pierin 26 indicates that a single clone can cover hundreds of acres. Everything near Boardman ultimately drains to the Columbia, and if Arundo donax reaches the Columbia River, it will be a disaster of unimaginable proportions. We, all of us, will be responsible to the citizens of Oregon and the citizens of Washington for generations to come for the devastation it causes. And early detection is very difficult. Small Arundo plants look like grass. The cost to monitor 50,000 or 90,000 acres will be astronomical to make sure it's not escaping. The fourth and final reason it will be an invader is that the short-term studies, Prosser and Boardman, do not demonstrate that it won't be invasive. They are operating on a kind of linearity principle, but invasive species don't invade by a linear principle. It's in fact a curvilinear relationship. What happens is they creep along, and then all of a sudden they shoot up, a bloom, so to speak. If we wait for the bloom, it will be too late. Shauna Bautista from the United States Forest Service gives the example of yellow-tuft alyssum, which we brought into the state predicted to be non-invasive. It was fine for decades, but then all of a sudden it became a noxious invader. She now spends most of her job taking care of that. It's an A-listed weed in Oregon at the present time. In fact, as people have already said, Arundo donax was present in California for at least 100 years before it became a noxious invader. And now it's taking up $70 million so far in the entire state budget. Furthermore, Glasser and Glick in 2012 note that we don't know what the effects of climate change will be, but it almost certainly will help to spread the plant. Some, the ODA, for example, have argued that there are places that Arundo donax won't grow, like the Arctic. There are places where it does grow, like where it's invasive. Couldn't Oregon be that magic place in the middle where it grows but it doesn't become invasive? But the answer is no. If it grows so that it is commercially viable as a biofuel, it will become an invader because it will be a very vigorous plant. Ragu 2011 indicated, the road to species introduction is often paved with good intentions, but it is littered with their consequent legacy. Control of invasive species, as you've already heard, requires a proactive approach. And the time to act is now, before we invest more money, time, effort into planting this invasive species in Oregon. I encourage you to look at page 9 and 10 of the handout I've given you, the NPSO statement on Arundo donax, at the Cal Weed Mapper report on the spread of Arundo donax. Don't let Oregon become California.
I was going to say, well, with that introduction, I think there's a lot of people in this room that would probably agree with that comment. Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Catherine McDonald. I'm the Director of Conservation Programs for the Nature Conservancy in Oregon. The Nature Conservancy works in partnership with private and public landowners across the state to address threats to native species and habitats. And we own and manage about 143,000 acres in Oregon.
Invasive species have been identified as the number one threat to species of conservation concern in the U.S. And the Nature Conservancy, just here in Oregon, spends a significant portion of our budget managing invasive species on the lands that we own, some $700,000 annually. So we look at this issue not only for concern for our mission, but also the potential cost to landowners like us and others. And as you've just heard, there's a lot of great history that we can look back on that indicates that even with the best of intentions, it's very challenging to control species for the long haul. They may occur at a low level for a long time and then, as was just described, kind of explode at some point in time. And a great example of that is Japanese knotweed, which has been sold in Oregon for quite some time as an ornamental species, and about 10 to 15 years ago just started to explode on our rivers across western Oregon especially. It's also now in eastern Oregon and occurs in about 26 counties in the state. The Nature Conservancy has spent a great deal of time and effort just on one river over the last decade to try and control Japanese knotweed. And it's a species that spreads in a similar fashion to giant cane. So you've heard a lot about the concerns about it from previous speakers today, so I won't spend time to go over that again with you, but just know that in addition to the current concerns about costs, it also has the potential to really impact a lot of the great work that we've been able to do to restore riparian habitats for fish and wildlife in the past 15 years. You just heard about the costs to control it. One study reported that it costs close to $25,000 an acre to control Arundo. So I'll just close with a couple of recommendations in addition to some that you heard earlier from the Oregon Invasive Species Council that we would support. We really encourage the Department of Agriculture to reconsider the status of Arundo in Oregon and put it on the A list. We also encourage them to develop some maps of where suitable habitat might be using climate projection models. We appreciate PG&E's efforts to come up with a creative solution for the Boardman plant and also to keep jobs in Morrow County, but we urge them to find a different fuel stock for their plant. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of these presenters?
Yes. Yeah. You just mentioned that PG should come up with an alternative fuel stock. Can you offer that opportunity to them and tell them what would be good for them?
Well, that's probably not as well as they did. And I thought they talked about some great options for Oregon, some of the plant materials that are grown in the area already, the plant waste, possibly juniper. I know that there are a lot of issues around any fuel source in terms of trucking it and getting it to Boardman, but those are some that we'd like to see. Those are some that we'd like to see looked at.
I was going to say, I think Senator Prezonsky would offer hemp.
Hemp again?
Industrial hemp.
Industrial hemp, yeah. Rebecca, that.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator.
Give me a follow-up.
No.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Since we're running short on time, I just want to make a few closing comments on this, and we'll encourage everybody to read through at your leisure the information. I don't think this is going to be the last time that we hear about this issue. I will say that as chair and somebody who has spent quite a bit of time along riparian areas in the state dealing with some of the invasive species that have been named here today, one of them Japanese knotweed, which actually the amount, the incredible veracity that plant spread through the state in such a short amount of time certainly is good reason to be cautious. But I will say that I'm looking forward to getting more information. This is something this committee will be tracking from the Invasive Species Council, Department of Agriculture, working with the Weed Board. I will say that we've had this issue in front of our committee before when we were dealing with canola, and there is a great concern in the Willamette Valley about potential cross-pollinization with the specialty seed crop. I dealt with that for several years working with the Department of Agriculture, and hopefully they will proceed with the same amount of caution that they did with that issue. I know that's being revisited right now, but certainly for the amount of time and effort and money that we're spending on our invasive species program, I think it's really important that we are cautious. I'm speaking to the Invasive Species Council tomorrow morning at their annual meeting in Portland, so it's certainly something that I've been tracking for many, many years, and we'll probably be revisiting this as we get more information from the researchers. So I want to thank everybody who was able to come here today and provide the information. Certainly it's something this committee and members and the chair will be working on. Thank you. And we're going to shift a little bit to from invasive species to water quality. So we have a panel to talk about water quality trading programs in the state. This is an innovative program that we've talked about in this committee, but we actually have a couple of practitioners that are going to be able to come and present their information and provide concrete examples of how this is working in Oregon. So I appreciate we have the Public Works Director from the City of Ashland that's come here today, Mike Fott, is that how you, I'm saying that right? And Walt Meyer from West Yost, who is this your consultant, is that correct? Or a consultant that's worked with the City of Medford, is that?
City of Medford.
Right. Mm-hmm. We did invite the City of Medford, but they couldn't be here today, so we have Walt Myers. And then actually when Bobby Cochran from the Willamette Partnership, who's also going to provide an overview. So thank you, gentlemen, for being here today.
Great. Chair Dingfelter, members of the committee, my name is Bobby Cochran, Executive Director with the Willamette Partnership. And we're just going to switch the order on you a little bit. We had an order of a presentation here that seemed to make good sense. So again, my name is Bobby Cochran with Willamette Partnership. And water quality trading has been around for a long time in this country. And Oregon, it's been around really since 2001. And at its face, it's really a way to provide flexibility for communities to meet their water quality trading goals. So you'll hear most importantly from City of Ashland, City of Medford and others about how wastewater facilities are not just thinking about how they can meet their water quality goals through concrete and steel, but also through restoring streams in a way that provides savings for ratepayers, healthy fish, happy communities. And so I'll be turning it over to Mike and Walt to give some of the specifics there. And then David Primozich with the Freshwater Trust is also here to answer any technical questions that
Great.
We have.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for making the trip here today.
Thanks. Thank you.
Chairperson, Senator Dan Fandler, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Walt Meyer. I'm with West Yost as a consulting engineer, but I'm also the Metro Wastewater Management Commission for Eugene-Springfield, which serves the greater metropolitan area of Eugene-Springfield area. I'm going to give you this afternoon some examples of how trading can work effectively for communities. And
did I get one already?
First of all, it's been used for temperature, and there's an example there. The Clean Water Services in Washington County has been using it now for 10 years on the Tualatin River, and it's been very effective. And both Medford and us in MWMC are using temperature trading to meet our temperature requirements in our discharge permits from the wastewater treatment facilities. Also, it can be used for other parameters, specifically oxygen-demanding type of parameters, and more important, for nutrients. And I'll talk just very, very briefly about those also. I have here today three examples, and the first one is the City of Medford, which I'll spend most of my time on. But then I also want to talk about the South Suburban Sanitary District, which discharges into the Klamath River, and you've heard a lot about that river. And then for Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission, where we're also doing some trading for temperature. Medford is a relatively large plant. It serves all of the metropolitan area of the Rogue Valley except for Ashland, but all of the other cities are served by this particular plant. About 170,000 people, and we discharge about 17 million gallons a day on an average day. It's a large facility, and I put this slide up to simply show you on the upper left-hand corner of the slide, you see the Rogue River, and you can see the riffle there. And on a fall day, you can go up there and see the salmon spawning right below the discharge of the treatment plant. So temperature is a significant issue in the Rogue River. And in fact, in the wild and scenic portion of the river down near Robinson's Bridge, the river does not meet the temperature criteria that DEQ has established for protection of salmonids. Consequently, the DEQ has issued a total maximum daily load limit to the discharges, and Medford is one of those, which establishes a maximum temperature load that can be discharged to the river. And this graph kind of shows you what that means in the late summer and early fall. The blue line is the temperature of the effluent that's being discharged. And this is on a sort of a dry season. The red line shows that the temperature that's allowable during that period of time. And you can see in September and as you go into October, the temperature that's being discharged is higher than is allowed to meet the thermal load that's been allocated at the plant. And as the Rogue Valley grows, that problem is only going to get worse because the load is fixed, and so as there's more flow, the temperature has to be even lower. So it's an ongoing problem. And of course, this is now reflected in the permit that DEQ recently issued to the Medford plant. These are specific thermal limits that limit the amount of temperature that Medford can put into the receiving water. We looked at the full range of alternatives. We looked at internal plant changes. For example, we are right now changing the cogeneration engine from water-cooled to air-cooled so that heat is not dumped into the wastewater, which eliminates millions of BTUs. We looked at evaporative cooling, but the ones that are kind of in, well, the effluent chillers, the effluent storage, and temperature trading are the three that are really, that will actually work. The last one, which was beneficial reuse, which would be irrigation, doesn't work because the most critical time in Medford is middle of October to the end of October, and there's no water demand at that time. So if we put water on the fields, we're just dumping, we're not irrigating. It's not beneficial use. So we did a life cycle cost analysis of the three alternatives, looking at a 20-year period, both capital cost and O&M cost. And as you can see, temperature trading by far is the most cost-effective way of meeting the requirement versus putting in chillers and thousands of horsepower of chilling capacity or storing hundreds of millions of gallons of effluent until such time it can be discharged after the critical period has passed. Given that, DEQ has done, a very good job of establishing the parameters that we can use to actually evaluate how temperature trading will work. This includes criteria, and what does that involve? How do we restore the riverbank? And these are some of the parameters, a 60-foot wide of planting, a pretty hefty stand of plants using Oregon native plants, trees and shrubs, and removing invasive species, primarily blackberries in the Rogue Valley. And a significant amount of soil preparation is necessary to make this really work. In addition, there is monitoring required, annual monitoring, so that we can prove that the stand is actually taking place. Maintenance, which includes in the first couple of years irrigation to make sure that the trees get established, continued invasive species controlled, and replacement, so if there's any mortality of stems, that those are replaced. And finally, there's landowner payments. The people that own the land adjacent to the streams that are being restored will enter into agreements with them, and they'll get annual lease payments, so there's actually some revenue on their part for the land that's being restored. And finally, there's third-party independent verification and certification that this restoration is actually there in place and doing its job. Given that, Medford had two options. One, it could staff up and begin entering into landowner agreements and planting and maintaining these stands. This is the approach that the Clean Water Services has taken in Washington County. Or Medford could contract for services, which is what they chose to do. They have entered into an agreement with the Freshwater Trust. The Freshwater Trust will take the responsibility for entering into the landowner agreements, planting, maintaining, and certifying the temperature credits. Medford makes an upfront payment for those credits. This is a table that shows the schedule of anticipated credit purchases. This is not exact. It'll vary depending upon the sites that are found and the miles that can be restored. But this is what we have to do in the next 10 years to be in compliance with our permit. And the way this will work is that the city will be purchasing the credits fully loaded. When they purchase a credit, it includes not only the cost of restoration, it includes the cost of the landowner payments, includes the cost of operation and maintenance, monitoring, everything up front, so that Medford essentially is finished with that credit for the next 20 years. I'm going to mention just very briefly the Klamath River. You've heard a lot about the Klamath River, especially about the water wars, but you've also heard about the fish kills, and those have been primarily related to lack of oxygen, which is a function of the nutrients in the river. This is a complex system. I'm working with the South Suburban Sanitary District for planning to meet their TMDL for both nitrogen and phosphorus. And the idea here is, and in fact the Freshwater Trust is now working with DEQ to establish the metrics for how many acres of agricultural land do you have to have where you would change the farming practices to reduce 1 pound of phosphorus that goes to the river, and how much would that cost. And the idea would be similar to Medford, where the communities would enter into agreements with the farming community where the community would pay for those credits, farmers would change farming practices, and that would offset the cost of what municipalities would have to pay for treatment. Now, South Suburban Sanitary District is looking at somewhere between $40 and $60 million in capital cost to meet the temperature or to meet the TMDL for nutrients. That's a lot of money to work with as you're looking for trading with the farming community, and we are actually quite optimistic that this too will work, but the metrics for this have to be worked out. In Eugene Springfield, we also have a TMDL for temperature on the Willamette River, and we're looking at a wide range of options, but we have already entered into an agreement with the Freshwater Trust to do temperature trading on two tributaries of the Willamette, Cedar Creek and the Springfield Mill Race. Again, the idea is to purchase credits from the Freshwater Trust, for which helps us meet our discharge requirements to the Willamette River. So I'd like to conclude with three basic conclusions. One is that we need to take a holistic approach with our rivers. We've done a very good job over the last 30, 40 years improving the water quality, where we've looked at the water column, but a river system is more than that. It's the riparian areas and the areas that feed into the river. Trading gives us the opportunity to do it even better than we have been doing it. Trading provides us an opportunity to improve the return on investment. There are going to be times where we can do the trading for less money and actually get a better job because we are improving the river system. And finally, as communities, we have to do this right to be able to garner the trust of the public and the environmental communities, because if we don't do it well, then this isn't going to work in the long term. So we have a vested interest in doing this very, very well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. My name is Mike Fott. I'm the Public Works Director of City of Ashland. Previously been Public Works Director in Staten, and before that Ontario, so I've had the pleasure of working some great communities. And my story is really not much different than what Walt shared for these other communities, other than to say we just recently completed our wastewater master plan, where we engaged our community in looking at our options to meet our temperature standards. And I have to say, when we start talking about this trading option, Ashland's a very environmentally sensitive community, and not unlike others, but Ashland likes to be involved in all of our decisions in our community. And the level of excitement when we talked about this option, the trading versus the three options that we narrowed down our master plan, were similar again to what Walt mentioned, but we looked at reuse. We purchased 800 acres of property years ago to land apply, and the plan looked at irrigating 400 acres at a cost of about $10 million. And the problem with our community, when you take the effluent out of the stream, there are times that we're over 50% of the flow. So then you have to look at bringing flow back into that stream. And as we also take our drinking water from Ashland Creek, and we have supply constraints in 2038 for drinking water. So certainly there's no easy option to augment that flow.
And again, $10 million in cost just to build the piping and to reuse. The other thing we looked at were chillers, or actually cooling tower. In our case, we'd also have to augment that with the chiller, because we, even with the cooling towers, we wouldn't be able to meet our temperature standards. And that cost between $9 and $12 million. Or the option that we decided on was this temperature trading, where it's not just the point source, the temperature at the source, but looking at the watershed, watershed health, for $2.9 million. It's certainly the most economic option that we had, but the one that our community really wrapped their arms around and thought that was a great idea. In fact, we had our council meet with DEQ as we went through this option, and I have to say there's a level of excitement about looking at this stream approach as opposed to just a point source approach. So I really don't have any more to offer other than what Walt said, but certainly there's that level of excitement that this is the right thing to do for the future. So.
And I think just in closing, there's a lot of people that deserve a lot of credit for this as well. I think Department of Environmental Quality has shown a lot of flexibility in providing a flexible alternative for communities. The wastewater facilities at Clean Water Services, City of Ashland, City of Medford, South Suburban, Metropolitan Wastewater are all taking a very proactive approach to how you meet water quality goals. Conservation groups are stepping up to say, how do we make this work so that we can be connecting communities, connecting farmers, and connecting the environment.
Okay. Any other questions? Sorry to step out for a minute.
We haven't asked questions yet.
Yeah. Okay. I saw him talking. I thought there was a question over there. So, any questions?
Yes. And gentlemen, I think in February we saw this as ecosystems marketing. Are we, is this a cap and trade bill that we're switching around? Hmm. We've changed it to water quality trading. So my question is, I've read the DEQ reports on Clean Water Services. And back in 2001, 2002, 2003, there was tremendous skepticism on temperature trading, whereas trees do not effectively cool a river. They basically slow down the warming of it, but they don't cool it. Because if you could cool it, you could put an umbrella over a 12-pack of beer and have some ice cold beer in about half an hour. So how does this doesn't really solve a problem, it just mitigates a problem at a cheaper cost.
About 7 minutes.
And we can probably make a hemp umbrella, too, to make it work better.
Jared Dingfelter and Senator Olson, let me use your beer analogy.
Please.
Because the water at Medford meets the criteria. But when it gets all the way down the Robinson Bridge, which is 70 miles, I think, plus or minus, further away, it no longer does. So if I have a six-pack of beer and I stick it in the sun, it's going to warm up very quickly, but right. If I put it in the shade, it'll stay cool.
So, follow-up question. You would have to take care of both sides of the river. And if the river is a half a mile wide, how is this shading going to affect the entire breadth and width of that water to provide that coolness?
The mechanism of any specific reach of the river or creek is influenced by the aspect of that body of water. So, if, for example, right at where that picture I showed you, the plant, the river's flowing east-west, and since the sun's aspect is towards the south, if you do shading on the southern bank, you're going to be more effective. But the way it works is that when a site is identified, DEQ has modeled the entire river system and has a model of how shade influences and what the effective shading is. We're going to try to find sites where the existing effective shading is poor. And then once the shading is in place, you can model before and after and see what the difference is. Okay? And then that is the basis for calculating how many kilocalories you've prevented the river from heating by doing this work. And then in addition to that, there's a trading ratio. So let's say that we've shown in this reach we've prevented 1 million kilocalories of heating, but because of the rules, the way DEQ set it up, then we would be able to get credit for half of that or 500,000 kilocalories of shading.
And can I just follow up? If you were not using this technique, you would be still responsible for cooling, for reducing those stream temperatures through probably, like I'm looking at your chart here, through more expensive technology, is that correct?
We would be responsible for reducing the heat load from our discharge, yes.
Which you should be.
Correct.
regardless of whether you plant trees along a river or not. Once again, as I say, you mitigate, you reduce, you take a problem over here and you pay for a problem over here and you try to balance them off. And it really, you still inject the problem into the stream system. This might help, but it certainly doesn't relieve you of the responsibility to cool your own water coming out, does it?
The entire concept behind trading is that instead of, let me give you a method, installing several thousands horsepower of chillers, which of course has its own environmental impact in terms of energy production, and then chilling the water to reduce the temperature of our water, what we're doing is preventing the water from heating by restoring the natural condition of the stream to reach its temperature potential through natural conditions rather than installing a chiller at the plant.
Follow up. But what happens 20 years down the road after your lease is up? Or what happens if the property transfers ownership? Who owns it all?
The property, of course, is always owned by the property owner.
Okay.
The cities will only get credit, or they will only maintain those temperature credits that they purchased as long as the restoration is maintained. If at any time, either through actions of the owner or through natural conditions, the shading is destroyed, then the city has to replace that shading or find another alternative to meet their commitment.
Okay.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for that information. I think so. We were going to have David come up just to answer questions. Is that right, or do you want to have?
Do you want to say hello?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming here today. Really appreciate it. And David, did you want to add anything, or are you just here to answer questions? Okay,
come on,
great.
Up and say a few words.
Thank you. Well, this puts us back on schedule. So we are now right on schedule, which is to receive an update on the Holgate Channel. And committee members, you may recall, we'll have the director, Scott Bruin, of the Oregon State Marine Board, and Travis Williams, the executive director of the Riverkeeper, that we had some hearings on this last session. And actually, I think I'll ask Scott if you can provide the committee just with an update on just to refresh everyone's memory about the Holgate Channel. That would be helpful.
Sure.
I know you know this off the top of your head. That's why you don't have any hair left, right?
That would be correct. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, director of the Oregon State Marine Board. A pleasure to be with you this afternoon and talk a little bit about what's going on in the Holgate Channel and where we are, what we accomplished last year, what we hope to accomplish this year, and get any of your thoughts or your questions and be able to answer those. So just for a little bit of background, I did send a letter to the committee in February as required for a budget note we had in our recent budget regarding the Holgate Channel and what had occurred in 2011, but we have had some changes since then, so I won't spend a lot of time on those pieces, but talk a little bit more about some of the changes that have occurred. In 2010 and 2011, the Marine Board established a couple of rules establishing slow no-wake zones in the Holgate Channel and in the Ross Island Lagoon. If you look at the back, the last page of the handout that I provided, there is some pictures of the lagoon that show where the slow no-wake zone was established. What we essentially established was an area from, once you get across the Willamette River, you can paddle up through the south part of the Holgate Channel and into the Ross Island Lagoon without having excessive wakes or boats going by at a quick pace. It was the board's belief that this would be a good area to have separated from the other parts of the Willamette River, the congestion in the Willamette River, where folks could paddle without having to worry about either the wakes or just the congestion of a lot of motorboats in that area. So they established the rule, which is in OAR 250-020-0280. So some things that happened in 2011, and this is also, there's some pictures on the back of your of the handout. We put some signage up. There's signage at Willamette Park, so people are aware of where the slow no wake zone is. We put a floating buoy in place on the south end of the channel, and we also put signage on the entrance to the Ross Island Lagoon. What we weren't able to get accomplished in 2011 was to put a buoy on the north end of the south part of the channel, near the lagoon entrance. Working with Ross Island Sand and Gravel, that's where their tugs turn. So finding a spot where that buoy could be placed without it creating a problem for them, we couldn't come to a conclusion during the summer. However, they will be placing a buoy this summer, so that there will be a buoy on both ends of the Holgate Channel. We also had a meeting on July 22nd of 2011 with a number of paddling organizations, going through the rules and also explaining to them how they should report violations, particularly to the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. When they call us 3 days later, unless they have an OR number off the boat, there's not a whole lot we can do versus calling the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office when it happens, and if River Patrol is in the area, they can respond to that. We also provided 1,000 leaflets to paddling clubs, liveries, boat shops, dealers, parks, law enforcement, and to the Willamette jet boats. In 2011, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office conducted 223 patrol hours in that vicinity. That's compared to 38 hours the previous summer. As you know, the previous summer, Kyron Horman investigation took up a lot of the time of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. So this past summer, they were able to devote a lot more time to enforcement in that area. There were 29 warnings given, no citations. We really wanted to focus this past summer on making sure people were aware of the zone, particularly since we did not have a slow and awake buoy on the north end of the south part of the channel. Folks would not necessarily, if they were coming in via the north side of the channel, they would know that there is a slow and awake zone. So a lot of the time was just spent in the education arena. So as you can expect, the results from the summer were pretty mixed. We received a lot of complaints from boaters. We also had other boaters that contacted us that says it was much improved over previous summers. One of the main areas that we did receive complaints regarding was the Willamette jet boat operations within the lagoon. They go into the lagoon with the passengers, and they do high-speed turns. They're a lot of fun. If you've never had a chance to do them, they're a great time. But in an area where there's a lot of paddling craft, and it's anticipated that it's a slow no-wake zone, and folks are not expecting to have wakes, it can be quite traumatic for the folks that are in there trying to enjoy a calm day. So we had a lot of information come in from folks, a lot of complaints regarding that activity. We also did a survey in December through February to find out, it was just an online survey to find out from users what their perceptions were of the rules that were put into place. Of the survey, 68% of the respondents were paddlers and 25% were general motorized boat users, or they were wakeboarders, fishermen, or sailboat users. Similarly, we received quite a difference in the responses that we received. The majority of motorized boaters responded when asked the question, do you feel that the slow and awake zones address safety and user conflict issues in the Holgate Channel? And keep in mind, this question asked the entire channel. The north side of the channel is still open for folks to go at any speed. The south end is the slow and awake. So when people were answering this question, they were considering the entire channel. 72% of the motorized users said no, they do not feel that the slow and awake zones address the safety and user conflict issues. 60% of the paddlers responded yes. And this disparity obviously highlights the difference in perception between the two groups. Some other results that were statistically significant, motorboat use in the channel was reduced from 25% to 15%. Wakeboarding use declined from 15% to 1%. Water skiing use declined from 15% to 2%. And then 40% of dragon boaters believe the slow no wake zone addressed safety and user conflict issues. One of the things we looked at after the summer is, what authority do we have to deal with commercial vessels in the slow no wake zone? Our belief based on statute was that commercial vessels were exempted from the rules that we put into place for recreational boaters. However, in looking at the statute, what we found out is that most commercial vessels are exempted from our rules. However, the legislature has put into the statute that passenger vessels under 100 tons are automatically unexempted from the exemption. So what that means is we cannot, by rule, exempt passenger vessels under 100 tons from our rules. So we had to go back and change that rule so that passenger vessels under 100 gross tons, this rule would also apply to them, which will affect the Willamette jet boat going into this summer. Okay. So for future activities, The floating sign on the south end of the channel was dislodged this winter, as normally happens with the high water flows in the Willamette. The water flows are still too high right now to get it placed back into a spot, but once the river levels go down, we will be placing that buoy back where it belongs in the south end, and we'll be installing the buoy on the north end. Additionally, this summer, we're working with Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. We're looking at providing some additional funding to them for this area for enforcement, bringing the number of hours up to about 300. The biggest complaint we're receiving right now is not the Holgate Channel up there. It is around the TriMet Bridge project. That bridge project has created some real issues because of the buoys in place, and they're forcing everybody through a narrow channel. So Multnomah County will also be working hard enforcing that area because it's my belief that that's probably the most dangerous area we're going to be dealing with this summer in the Portland area. So that's pretty much the history of what happened last year and what we're planning on this year. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from Travis first, and we'll see if there's any questions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, and committee members. My name is Travis Williams, and I'm Executive Director and Riverkeeper for Willamette Riverkeeper. We were involved in the original petition to declare or push for this area being a no-wake zone. From my perspective, I think the Marine Board has been very responsive to the paddling community and others concerned about the kind of aesthetic qualities and wildlife protection, both in the southern portion of Holgate Channel and in the lagoon in Ross Island. And the board has worked hard to keep information flow going between the different elements of the paddling community and everybody who's interested in this issue. The only things I wanted to reiterate are what Scott has already said. I think it's important that we get a floating sign at the north end of the channel, given that we've had noticed a lot of folks firsthand last summer and into the fall cruising down that southern portion of Holgate Channel, and I think many of them just not noticing the signs that are on the island itself at the opening of the lagoon. In addition to that, I think the extra funding for the Multnomah County Sheriff's Marine Patrol can do a lot to get those, to have their presence really be felt during the peak times in that area and to help continue to educate boaters, folks that I can't paddle up to fast enough, even in my fast canoe, to let them know that this area is a no-wake zone and they should tone it down. So I would leave it at that, and again, wanted to commend the Marine Board on their effort to implement this rule. It's been a big job over the past few months.
Great. Hey, Travis, thank you very much. Could you, you didn't talk about number three on your list.
Yeah, I think one of the things I noticed there is I tried to report last summer the phone number listed for the Multnomah County Sheriff's Marine Patrol will often get you to a voicemail that kind of dead ends. That was my experience. And I think some of that's been ironed out, but I'm not positive. And I know other people have had that experience when they've had someone fly by them in the channel itself. The number that we're all supposed to be reporting to had not been well attended, I would say, or the response to those inquiries and complaints.
Questions?
Nope. Yep. I have a question. On the northern end, at the mouth of the lagoon, how do you propose to put a floating buoy out there if it's going to interfere with Ross Island's tugboats?
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson. The buoy will actually be a little bit further south because it can't sit right on the north end.
South of the entrance?
So it'll be south of the entrance a ways, but it will say the same information. So you're correct. There's no way to place it right on that north side because those tugs come through in that area.
Follow up? Is there a possibility to put signs at the north end of the island that would say that a no-wake zone will be present in the next 500 meters?
Chair Dingfelder.
Did they give him a heads up?
Senator Olson. We're looking at anything that will work. What we've really found out is for boats going at a high rate of speed, they don't stop to look at the signs.
They don't look.
If you don't have something in the channel. Now, the potential is we could put something in the channel, but then we're in the navigational channel. Okay. That'll be a concern for both the Coast Guard and for the barges that are going through there. So that creates its own concerns as well. We're hopeful that when they're coming up to the sign and they see it, or the one that's on the south end, that folks will slow down and not blow through that area.
One other follow-up? Mm-hmm. Yeah, is using more hours for the Sheriff's Department a very efficient use when there is so much water to cover?
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, that is certainly a concern for ours because Multnomah County does cover a huge amount of water. And we did have a death up on the Columbia River this year, a number of accidents in other areas. And when we're talking about patrol hours, they're working through that area. They're patrolling, but they are moving to other areas as well. We don't have the ability for them just to sit in a particular area and watch what's happening. One of the things that's important is that these conflicts, the conflicts in general, aren't arising in the midday on a week, during the week. They're not arising a lot of times in the morning. They're in the evenings and they're on the weekends. And so really targeting those patrols to try to get them to those areas when it's of most use is really to our benefit and to their benefit. But we don't have the funding and they don't have the personnel to provide the kind of coverage that they would be there all of the time.
Okay. Any other questions? Great. First of all, thank you both gentlemen for being here today. Scott, you can stay because you're up in the next panel, but I do want to, first of all, thank the Marine Board because, Scott, when you first came on, I think this was an issue literally that you picked up on day one, and I will say I've been very pleased with the response of the Marine Board. Obviously, you've heard there's still some issues that need to be worked out. You've highlighted them along with Travis, but I appreciate how responsive the board and the agency has been, and I'm hopeful that we'll just continue on that trajectory through the next season. Obviously, there are things out of your control, but making sure that folks have the right information. I just want to commend you on the work that you've been doing because I haven't heard the complaints that I heard when I first started working on this issue. And I think, you know, part of it is education, which I know you're working hard at. And I'm assuming then you're going to have to change these signs since it says on there that it exempts all commercial.
Yes, all those signs are going to have to be changed. Although, Chair Dingfelder, the only folks that are affected by this are Willamette Jet boats. They are aware of it, so.
And I'm assuming you're working with them directly.
We are working with them directly, yeah. And they, of course, came to the rules hearing and had concerns about the rule being put into place, understandably, from their perspective. But they are aware that it does apply to them.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Travis.
Thank you.
So we're going to segue right into the next issue, which is we've heard a little bit about invasive species today, and we're going to hear an update on the Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program, again, from the director of the Marine Board, and also from Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Okay, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. I'll just provide a little bit of the background and then turn it over to these two gentlemen to talk about the actual program and what's been accomplished and where we've been and where we're going. So a little bit of background. In 2009, the Oregon Legislature passed House Bill 2220, which created the AIS Prevention Program, and House Bill 2583, which established the Clean Launch Law, which made it illegal to launch a boat in Oregon waters unless it's free of aquatic invasive species. Along with that, we had a user fee that for boaters, which helped to raise money for that program. It is dedicated funding, which serves just that program. and the program is currently co-managed by the Marine Board and by Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The primary objective of the program is to protect Oregon's water bodies against the introduction and spread of AIS. In August of 2011, House Bill 3399 was passed and signed by the governor, which gave us the authority to require all watercraft to stop when passing an open aquatic invasive species inspection station. A lot of what we're going to talk about today will address what happened last summer with those mandatory stations and then what we hope to accomplish this summer as well. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Glenn Dolphin, our Aquatic Invasive Species Program Manager, to go through what we're doing at the Marine Board.
Thank you.
Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Glenn Dolphin, the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator for the Oregon Marine Board. As Scott gave you the background, I'm going to lay out how the agencies co-manage the program together, a little bit about our outreach to boaters, a little bit about the revenue and the permits, and then turn it over to Fish and Wildlife for their half. So the Marine Board is the primary agency managing the permit program. As Scott alluded to, there is a new fee on boaters that supports the program activity. So we oversee that fee permit program. We also coordinate outreach and education efforts through many of the program partners, one of them being the Aquatic or the Oregon Invasive Species Council and those members. We also coordinate and oversee implementation of the law enforcement activities for the program, as we as an agency contract with county sheriff departments and Oregon State Police for boating law enforcement. Department of Fish and Wildlife, as Rick will speak about, the primary responsibility for implementing the boat inspection program, also partners with education and outreach and other management activities for invasive species. So outreach to boaters, seeing that it's still a fairly new program, we're approaching our third summer of the program. We've done a lot of outreach to boaters the last couple of years, so I just wanted to give a quick overview of that. The handout that was given out was the 2011 annual report, and we do an annual report every year so far. We will continue that. So some of this information is in there. I'll go through it quickly. 2010, the first year, we, as both agencies together, we did 11 press releases to the public. That resulted in actually 60 articles in 31 different newspapers statewide. So it was a good turnout that year. The agencies together that year in 2010, we did 47 presentations or trainings to groups around the state, and we attended 19 different public boating events or sportsman shows or boat shows, that kind of thing. 2011, last year, the agencies did 9 press releases, resulting in 26 articles in 14 different Oregon newspapers. We continued on with 44 additional presentations and trainings to groups around the state, and we attended 18 public events last year. Additionally, the agencies, myself and Rick, we've been interviewed for radio and TV news stations about the program itself. Oregon boat ramp managers, county and city parks, those folks that manage those access points, they've been given signs to install at their boat ramps around the state that inform the public of the laws and invasive species prevention. The agencies, along with many of our partners, have websites full of aquatic invasive species information, including the boat permits and inspection programs. Businesses that sell our permits for us, they sell hunting and fishing licenses through Fish and Wildlife Point of Sale. They all have printed brochures and posters at their point of sale informing the public of the program requirements. We now have, through partnership with ODOT, 20 large signs on our highways leading into the state that are 10-foot by 5-foot, and they say all watercraft state law requires invasive species permit. Those have just been completed this last winter. And our law enforcement officers, when they're out on the water making contact with boaters, hand out printed materials and inform the people of the program. I'll just touch a little bit about the permit revenue stream that comes in for the program. We essentially have 3 different boat categories that fit into the permit fee requirement. We have the Oregon registered motor boats in the state, and they are required to pay a $5 fee at the time of their 2-year boat registration renewal that they do with the Marine Board. We have non-motorized boats, 10 feet in length or longer. and they are required to carry a $5 annual permit, or they can buy a $10 two-year permit to carry on board. Those permits end up being transferable to other non-motorized boats in the category. One permit per boat is what's required. We also have non-resident motorboat operators coming into the state of Oregon, and they're required to purchase an annual $20 permit that also ends up being transferable within that non-resident motorboat category. Permits are available either, as I mentioned earlier, through the ODFW point-of-sale system. Throughout the state, there's approximately about 500 businesses selling hunting and fishing licenses. You can buy a permit at those businesses. The ODFW website has an online portal for purchasing online. The Marine Board sells a Tyvek tag type permit. We utilize the mail application form, and we also have 26 approved businesses in the state selling our Tyvek tags for us. Over the last 2 years, on the revenue end, as Scott mentioned, it is a dedicated fund set up in statute to only be used for the Invasive Species, Aquatic Species Fund. 2010 revenue, the first year, we raised $831,000. 2011 revenue was $939,000. We still believe that we are lower than our expected revenue numbers in the non-motorized boat category and the non-resident motorboat category are two categories that we have our outreach efforts primarily focused on, as they have to go physically buy a permit. They're not in a Marine Board system like our registered boats. So we've allocated some funds to our law enforcement partners starting in 2012 from the AIS fund to increase compliance checks out in the water when they're out this summer, to try and assist with further educating and outreaching to those folks that may not realize they have a permit, and then also for enforcement officers to do what they feel is necessary for enforcement of the laws. There's maybe just let ODFW go next, and we could do questions afterwards. Thank you.
Senator Dingfelder, committee members, for the record, I'm Rick Boatner, the Invasive Species Wildlife Integrity Coordinator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'll just give you a summary of what we've done since we started the program, what we're doing this year, and what we're going to be attempting to do in 2013, and a couple of the challenges that we're seeing with the inspection program. 2010 started our program, and that year we did 2,852 inspections. Of those, we did 17 decontaminations. None of them were for quagga and zebra mussels. All were for Eurasian milfoil or other aquatic invasive species plants. In 2011, and mind these are all on a voluntary basis, these boaters stop in to be inspected. In 2011, we did 3,614 inspections. Of those, we had 79 decontaminations. Six of them were for quagga and zebra mussels located on the boat. Again, that was on a voluntary basis. In that year of August of 2011, House Bill 3399 got signed by the governor. And so we did our first law enforcement efforts in port of entry during Ashland on September 2nd. On that, we had 27 vessels bypass our check stations, and each of out of those 27, 25 were stopped. We're all issued warnings, but part of the information that we gather, we asked the law enforcement officers to ask them why they didn't stop. Most common answer was didn't see the sign, which we thought odd because we had big construction sign that said mandatory boat inspection ahead, and then four signs that are approved by ODOT for that speed, one saying boat inspection ahead, the other one said mandatory boat inspection, the other one saying boat inspection next right, and then the final saying given an arrow to where to go. The other one excuse was I didn't think it applied to me. That was interesting because we had one only applies to Californians, and that was from a boat registered from Texas. Mm-hmm. The other ones, I only boat in Oregon waters. The other one, I have a canoe. And my favorite personally was I forgot I had a canoe on top of my rig. So we heard a bunch of excuses for those 27 boaters that went by.
Previously, before the mandatory law went in effect, we were having anywhere from a 27% compliance rate of boaters stopping in 2010. 2011, it moved up slightly to 42% compliance rate. And after our first law enforcement, it went anywhere from, depending on the day, 50 to 72% compliance rate. For 2012, with the new law passed last year, we moved all the inspection stations to our borders to try to catch boats coming into it. Our first inspection station was in Central Point, and that started on May 1. And the other one was in La Grande, which started on May 9th. We've already caught two boats, one in La Grande, one at Central Point, one with quagga mussels, one with zebra mussels on it. We've also this year, our big effort push for both agencies has been outreach and education. We've already done 8 level 1 trainings, 6 aquatic invasive species talk to various organizations, and worked 3 sportsman shows. We will soon hopefully have these Klamath Falls port of entry check station going and the Hines check station going, and that's the intersection of 395 and Highway 20. We're still recruiting. We're in our second round of recruiting for employees for that. In 2013, we are going to eliminate the Fish and Wildlife Supervisory position and create 4 new positions for to create 2 new inspection teams. With that, we're going to open the Central Point check station starting February 1, and that was based on Idaho. Started theirs February 1 this year, and by the time May came around, they already had stopped 30 boats that had quagga or zebra mussels on it. We're also going to go to 7 days a week at Central Point. Currently, we're working 5 days a week at these check stations. One of our biggest challenges to the program is the lack of other states doing proper decontamination or inspections, especially Lake Mead with the National Park Service. Lake Mead has about 1.5 trillion adult mussels and 3.2 trillion villagers, which is the microscopic stage that we're worried about coming in on boats. So it's a very high risk. And Lake Mead does not notify us that boats are coming in and does not do any proper decontamination or inspections. So that's one of our biggest concerns, our biggest highest risk. And again, hopefully we can recruit some more employees to man our check stations, and especially as we increase next year's to a couple more check stations. With that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Thompson?
With all the increase, are these license fees paying for that, or where are you getting the dollars to change your personnel around to do all this?
Sure. No, all the funding comes through the Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program.
Yeah, there's enough money
yes.
in that. So you said one of your check stations was in La Grande. Why? I'm just curious why in La Grande and not in Ontario at the border. I'm just curious.
Well, they're based out of La Grande. They actually do the check station at Baker Valley Rest Area.
Okay.
And then they do some at Ontario. We kind of, for the first 2 years, we had roving bands. For lack, mm-hmm. So they were doing both roadside check stations and boat ramps around the state.
Okay.
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Thompson, yep. If I could also follow up on that. The funding that we currently have available in the program is not adequate to run 24/7 operations for boat inspections. I would love to get to the point where we could do that because we are taking the chance that boats can come through when we're not open. So one of the things that ODF&W is working on is how to find efficiencies so they can extend when these inspection stations are open, open them earlier, open them more times during the week so that we can accomplish more. But it really is our focus and our desire to get as much money as possible into those so that we can extend the hours. While the boating season is kind of May through September in Oregon, the season for a quagga or zebra to survive on a boat is when it's winter and it's wet and the boat's being transported up here in those kind of conditions out of season just to go to its next spot. And those species are on board the vessels. So extending it, as Rick is talking about, extending it further towards the winter would be a huge plus to being able to find these species when they're on board. I will also say that California and Idaho are good partners. They work very hard at finding these as they're on their way here, and so we have a little bit of a buffer from them. The other piece is the aquatic invasive species coordinators from the different states work very closely together, so a lot of phone calls get made very quickly when there's when people believe that a vessel is on the move that has these on board. But really, with the funding we have in place right now, there are openings, chinks in our armor, if you will, where something could get through.
Questions?
Yes. Yep. Oh, Chuck has another.
Chuck, do you have a follow-up?
Just a quick one. So,
Senator, sorry.
I don't. I like the first one. Support of entry thing, at least in several areas of the state. Why wouldn't you work with ODOT? Because how many boats come in? Do you have one person sitting there all day long waiting for a boat to come in? Or if you worked with ODOT and trained them to do it, and they could, all boats and all semi-trucks have to enter a port of entry or whatever those spots are, it would just make more sense maybe to, if you could train ODOT to work with you on that too, maybe save some dollars? I don't know.
And I noticed that's your last bullet point on your...
Yeah.
List of the summary, so I think that's a good question if you can talk about that.
Now, currently, Senator Dingfelder, Senator Thompson, currently as the rules are written, ODOT is not authorized to do boat inspections. Only Oregon Department of Ag, our agency, Oregon State Police, I'm missing one here, but they do help us. They have been very supportive of allowing us to operate at the port of entries. They have offered to help with their camera surveillance and stuff. So they've been very cooperative. The problem we're having, Idaho has already set up that on all their one-day haul permits or their one-use haul permits, that they notify Idaho Department of Ag, and then Idaho Department of Ag notifies the states where the boat's coming to. And that's been really effective. That's caught the first boat that we stopped at Baker Valley earlier this season. And with California, it stopped the first boat that we got at Central Point with zebra mussels. So it's been really cooperative with those. Oregon Department, ODOT, most of our haulers have continuous use permits. So that means they do not have to notify ODOT that they're coming in the state. They just got to pull and show their permit. So we're still working with them to develop a solution on their one-time permits, so we'll be notified.
Thanks. The first point I'd like to make, as a boater myself, I appreciate what you guys are doing. I fish bass tournaments all across the West, and it's important. I would maybe suggest that you change the sign that say all vehicles towing or transporting boats must stop to get the message in, because mandatory boat inspection, you kind of go, what's that mean? I'm on the freeway, you know. Next question. When you sterilize or clean these boats, what do you do with the wastewater?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Olson, with the wastewater, we have mats that we put under each of the boats, and so we rinse it off, we collect the water back up into the tank and dispose of it properly.
Okay. By properly, you've just got these little mussels in there now, right?
Yeah, well, generally, you just suck the water up, you sweep up the mussels, but we put it in a sewer system that's going to a containment unit or going to a treatment plant or somewhere. The other, for your signage question, the signs we have, it was ODOT approved, and our first original sign said that, but it was too wordy to be people to read at 70 miles an hour, so that's why we're not using that.
They shouldn't be towing a boat at 70 miles an hour.
I know, but you got to look out for everyone.
And next point, the Oregon Bass Federation is really adamant about these invasive species, and they have asked me to inquire as to voluntary inspectors, get training for voluntary inspectors, not having authority to decontaminate or hold people up. But many of us go to many different lakes at one time, and we could look at boats and do a voluntary inspection. Is that a program that you would ever consider, to have volunteers actually help you assist and spread that program out so we can have more people looking?
Senator Dingfelder, Senator Olson, yes, that's one we considered. We have already trained Coast Guard Auxiliary. We did two, three-level training sessions, almost 100
100 and some members of the Coast Guard Auxiliary, but we have offered the BAF clubs that we would train them in level one, and especially for their tournaments, they would be allowed to inspect their own boats as part of their rules.
Good. So, good. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, I have one last question for you all, and thank you. I mean, I know this program is in the infancy, and we're making progress as we go and learning, obviously. One thing as far as outreach, and I don't, you may have said this, but I'm not sure I caught it, as far as when people are buying their fishing licenses, is that something that is on your website or printed on the license? Because that's one way to obviously connect with a lot of boaters. Are you guys already doing that? Have you thought about doing that?
Well, it's on ODFW's website. When you go to the point of sale online system to check where what you want to buy, there is a message about aquatic invasive species permits. It's not physically printed on a fishing license, however. But like I mentioned earlier, the point of sale locations, the businesses do all have posters and printed materials on display.
Look like you're about to mention something.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder. One of the other things that we're really working on is folks that sell canoes and kayaks. A lot of places are selling those, and they don't let people know before they're out the door that they're required to have the aquatic invasive species permit. That is a great place to have that initial conversation with them. So from an educational perspective, that's something we're working hard on to get that information out to folks. But when a store hires a new guy every couple of weeks and go sell that boat, they may not necessarily know what they're supposed to tell people when they purchase them.
Question. On the canoes and kayaks, I know I had, there's actually a representative that has several kayaks, or several canoes on the Umpqua River, and he has one permit for like five boats. Does he need to have a permit for each boat?
No, it's just one permit per boat when it's in use on the water.
They can transfer it.
They
can transfer it. So
yeah.
If he has all five out or she has all five out,
he better have five permits.
Right.
If they're all out in the water at the same time, that's correct.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I think we'll continue to have updates, and this information is very helpful. And certainly, I'd like to hear, my staff will be checking back with you, I think, after the season on the challenges and summary, some of the recommendations that you have. I think we'd like to certainly continue to track the progress on that and some of the suggestions you've heard here today. As far as Lake Mead, where are they mostly coming up through California, by the way, when they're coming over? Are they coming over from eastern part of the state? Because I was curious about that.
A lot of times they come up from Utah, Idaho, and in.
Yeah.
Senator Dingfelder, it's generally Utah they're coming through. We have had some come through California through our Central Point or Ashland Station, but mainly it's the I-84 system.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. So we have one more panel and then a quick update. So we're hopefully going to get everybody out of here on time. We are going to continue now the hatchery overview and discussion that we've been having all year. And this last panel is from the fishing community. We have Jim Martin. Jim Bridwell, is that how you say it?
Yeah.
And Jeff Feldner. And gentlemen, I've got about 30 minutes total with questions, so if you can be mindful of your time, and then we'll have our last person up from the Water Resources Department. Great. Whoever wants to start?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, Senators, good afternoon. I'm Jim Martin. I'm a Science and Policy Advisor to the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association and presenting testimony on behalf of NSIA. I also work for a large fishing tackle company, Pure Fishing. I'm the former Chief of Fisheries for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, retired now, and served for 3 years as a advisor to Governor Kitzhaber when we developed the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. The topic of the conversation today is the origin and, more importantly, the future of hatcheries as part of the fish management system. And I'd like to boil down the reason why we have hatcheries to two primary reasons. One is fairness. The second is economics. In a discussion of fairness, we have to go back 150 years and look at the history of Oregon and the history of political decisions trading off wild salmon, trout, and steelhead habitat for dams, development, agriculture, timber. And many of the fishermen, the tribal fishermen, the commercial fishermen, and the recreational fishermen fought those trade-offs, but essentially lost. And the trade-off was, we're going to take this habitat away for other uses, and we're going to build hatcheries to try to keep the fishery whole, to try to be fair to everybody, to try to maintain the social and economic benefits in the community. And that's how we ended up with this large system of hatcheries that produce roughly 80% of the salmon, trout, and steelhead that we catch in Oregon today. Most of these hatcheries are funded by either mitigation dollars, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, or the Bonneville Power Administration, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, or Portland General Electric, or by sportsman's fees. A small amount of commercial fishing funding also goes into supporting the department management and hatcheries. In the old days, of course, we had an Oregon Fish Commission and an Oregon Game Commission. The Oregon Fish Commission ran commercial fisheries, and the Oregon Game Commission ran recreational fisheries. The Oregon Fish Commission was entirely supported by general fund. When those agencies were merged, the general fund was merged in. Essentially, it's all been taken away. We're down to 2% general fund in ODFW's budget now. So obviously, a continuing debate is, how important are these hatcheries, and how do we fund them? Another aspect of the fairness, in addition to being fair to tribal members and to commercial fishermen and to recreational fishermen, is an understanding of the role of the Pacific Salmon Treaty, which is a large treaty we signed the United States and Canada to ensure that we would have gravel-to-gravel management throughout the migration range of the North Pacific salmon. And one of the things we promised in 1985 when we signed that treaty, we promised to the Canadians and we promised to the Alaskans, was that we would maintain base hatchery production so that they didn't have to basically have reduced fisheries simply because we continued to reduce production by trading away the wild runs and then cutting the hatcheries. So there's an agreement in that treaty that says we will maintain base production as it was in 1985. Obviously, the tribal responsibility goes all the way back to the 1855 treaties. The second reason why we have hatcheries is because they are so important to our economy. Sport fishing alone creates $3 billion worth of economic value and 31,000 jobs in Oregon or in the Pacific Northwest. And 80% of those salmon, trout, and steelhead are hatchery produced. To understand how important it is, just look at our Oregon tourism marketing campaign. You will not be able to look at any brochure, any ad, and not see fish prominently displayed. We're obviously in a competition for those tourist dollars with Canada and Alaska. Canada and Alaska didn't trade away most of their wild habitat. They still have mostly wild runs. We traded away a large amount of our habitat and built hatcheries in response. A final note is, it's extremely important to maintain these fisheries so that we maintain license and excise base, so that we can maintain the funding base for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, so that that is actually what pays for conservation. Almost no general fund pays for conservation. So if we lost these hatcheries and lost the associated fisheries, we would also lose the fundamental core funding base for ODFW to do conservation and education, endangered species work, all the other aspects of Oregon's conservation program. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has always been a recognized national leader. We were the first ones to have a wild fish policy in the 70s, which put a priority on supporting wild fish and balancing wild and hatchery production. We began reforming fisheries on the Oregon coast in the 70s and 80s and have proceeded to reforming fisheries in the Columbia River in the 80s and 90s and in this decade. And we continue to be very advanced in terms of geographically and genetically separating hatchery fish and wild fish and striking the right scientific balance. And I expect that will continue far into the future, as you can see. I think that the thing to wrap up my comment with is just to think about the future. The future, by 2100, Oregon's going to have three times as many people as they had in the year 2000. we're essentially going to have the climate of Northern California. Neither of those is going to be good for wild fish. It's going to be a tremendous battle to be able to maintain any kind of natural functioning ecosystem in most of these rivers. It's unrealistic to think we'll ever be able to restore wild fish, to really be able to maintain the kind of large-scale consumptive fisheries it takes to support a tourist economy, a viable commercial fishery, even an intensive recreational fishery like the Columbia River Spring Chinook, where on average people fish 8 days to catch one fish, spend between $50 and $150 per day. And it's an economic engine that produces tremendous economics, tremendous jobs. We will need hatcheries for that job. ODFW will need to continue to exert leadership, working with National Marine Fisheries Service, the tribes, the other states in the Northwest, to design strategies to be able to balance this economic engine called hatcheries with the delicate business of restoring and maintaining sustainable wild stocks. So I'd just like to wrap up by saying all my life I've been working on this. I'm proud to have worked for ODFW. I'm proud to work for the sport fishing industry now, and I'm proud to share the podium with these partners. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go next?
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before the committee to discuss the importance of our state salmon and steelhead hatcheries, as well as the importance of recreational fishing to Oregon. My name is Jim Bridwell, a resident of Portland, and the Government Relations Committee Vice Chair for the Oregon Chapter of Coastal Conservation Association. CCA supports the important role hatcheries have to play in providing harvest opportunities while conserving, sustaining, and rebuilding salmon and steelhead stocks. We also support efforts to improve the efficacy of hatchery programs. This includes the mass marking of hatchery salmon and steelhead, as well as the adherence to science-based hatchery reform recommendations related to maintaining broodstock standards and the integrity of wild salmon populations. While substantial progress has been made implementing these recommendations, our commitment to sound hatchery management practices and the conservation of wild salmon should remain our first priority. Meanwhile, CCA also strongly supports selective fishing implementation as part of science-based hatchery and harvest reform efforts. Our region has made progress towards recovering salmon, restoring habitat, and improving hydroelectric operations. However, it is currently unrealistic to believe that we can sustain most salmon populations or fisheries, including those reserved by treaty rights, without a contribution from hatcheries. It is also important to remember that many hatcheries were constructed and continue to receive federal or utility funding as mitigation for the impact of hydroelectric dams. ODFW operates 32 different hatcheries and a number of associated rearing facilities. In 2011, ODFW hatcheries raised and released over 94 different stocks of salmon, steelhead, and trout. Of the nearly 42 million fish released, over 35 million were stocks of salmon and steelhead. The hatchery production is critical to sustaining these populations in recreational, commercial, and tribal fisheries. It is important to note that only 10% of the funding for ODFW hatchery operations come from the state general fund. The large majority of the funding is provided by federal agencies, license fee revenue, and power and water utilities. This hatchery production is particularly important to recreational fisheries. Since they are so dependent on opportunity, i.e. a chance of catching a fish, maintaining robust recreational salmon and steelhead fisheries are a win-win-win for Oregon. Under social and economic contributions, one of the most important benefits of our recreational fishing is the public recognition and support they build for conserving our fisheries and their habitat. Each year, approximately 500,000 Oregon residents and 120,000 non-residents purchase recreational fishing licenses from ODFW. These individuals truly have a vested interest in conservation, and many are at work in their local watersheds making a difference. Recreational fishing also helps to get residents of all ages, including younger generations, out of the house and into the natural environment. Economic contributions. Recreational fishing is also a significant economic engine for Oregon. In fact, data from ODFW indicates that Oregon residents and visitors spend approximately $783 million annually on recreational fishing equipment and travel-related expenditures. A large portion of this economic activity is directly attributable to salmon and steelhead fisheries across the state, particularly in the Columbia River, Willamette River systems.
Fiscal contributions, one of the most overlooked contributions of the recreational fishing is the revenue provided to ODFW by anglers. Without the license fee revenue provided by recreational anglers, the agency would be unable to fund its fisheries management and conservation activities. In fact, only $7 million, 2% of the $308 million in revenue ODFW expects this biennium will be derived from the state general fund. By comparison, over $70 million, or 23%, is attributable to recreational combination license sales and federal programs tied to taxes on sport fishing equipment to help fund departmental operating expenses. The department also receives another $16.7 million in dedicated license fee revenue, much of it from recreational fishing license buyers for important activities like the Restoration and Enhancement Program and the Fish Screening and Passage Grant Program. In summary, sound hatchery management and recreational fishing truly is a win-win-win for Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today and for your interest in helping to restore and sustain Oregon's salmon and steelhead fisheries.
Thank you. Mr. Palmer.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dinkfelder, Vice Chair Olson, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak for you in front of you today. My name is Jeff Feldner. I'm a resident of Logston on the Siletz River. I've been a commercial fisherman in Oregon since 1972, and I'm also currently employed by Oregon Sea Grant. Most of my familiarity with Oregon's hatchery operations comes from my experience in fishery management. I served on the Pacific Fishery Management Council Salmon Advisory Subpanel, representing Oregon from 87 to 95. I served two terms on the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission from 1995 to 2004, and I'm currently a member of the Pacific Fishery Management Council representing Oregon. Over that time, I've seen and probably actually been involved in the evolution of salmon management from what early on frequently focused on issues that were allocative in nature rather than about conservation, to the point where now management is much more focused on the responsibility to protect and properly steward wild stocks. Now, as you've heard in previous testimony and in testimony months before from the other groups that talked here, our fisheries, both in river and on the ocean, have become more dependent on the production of fish from the hatcheries. And I guess that probably my main point here is that as this evolution has played out, our management has come to realize that this responsibility, both for the wild stocks as well as for the public benefits of the fisheries, depends not so much on just maximizing the output of fish from the hatcheries as it does on being able to optimize the utilization of the fish from these hatcheries. And to this goal, I want to point out a couple of promising developments that I've seen happen. The first is our own Oregon Hatchery Research Center on the Alsea River. If you haven't had a chance to visit it, I'd really recommend that you go down and see it. It is a state-of-the-art facility, and it's a center for learning and testing hatchery science in ways that allow us to move toward these goals. It's not only aimed at protecting or minimizing impacts to wild fish, but it's also, they're also learning about ways to produce fish that are best utilized by the fisheries so that they don't, you know, higher return. The second is a project, or a series of projects that I've personally been involved on since 2006, and that is the advancement of our ability to manage these fish in the ocean, and the techniques that we've been studying use genetic stock identification in a collaborative program with fishermen on the ocean, where the fishermen collect samples. As they catch fish, they are contracted and trained to take little samples of scales, little samples of fin clip. When at the end of their trip, they bring these samples to the laboratory at Hatfield Marine Science Center, and within 48 hours, we can tell the origin of the fish, we can tell where it was caught in an area smaller than this room, and that includes its exact depth, and we can look at patterns of distribution of stocks, we can look at aggregation of stocks, and we can look at
how those move through time. What this opens up is the potential to really do what we're calling near real-time management. Up till now, we've relied on things like fin-clipped fish with an encoded wire tag, which, first of all, only studies hatchery fish. Second of all, you get back a really small percentage of the fish that you initially code. And third, it takes a long time to analyze them. Frequently, we don't have results from that testing until February of the year following the fishery. So I just wanted to point out those things as things we can look forward to in the future to be able to better utilize hatchery production. The genetic information is already being used in management of ocean fisheries. Some of the information has been used in setting areas off Northern California to avoid impacts on Sacramento winter Chinook, which are an endangered species. So it's pretty exciting. And thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Great, thank you. See if there's any questions. Center.
Mr. Martin, you had said that sport fishing generates $3 billion in economy in a year in our state?
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, that's correct, in the Pacific Northwest.
In the Pacific Northwest. And, sir, you said it was $783 million?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, those were numbers we got from ODFW, so that's the numbers we used.
Per year?
Per year.
Okay. Thank you.
That's it. Thank you. I have a question for you, Mr. Feldner. You had mentioned about the Oregon Hatchery Research Center, and I was actually there just prior to the opening and was on the committee that we funded it. Can you talk a little bit about, from your perspective, what the value of the research has come out of that and what you think the impact has been? I don't know if you're that familiar with...
I'm not intimately familiar with the projects that are ongoing.
If any of you want to answer that, yeah.
I don't know if either of you folks are. I do know that they're studying things like release timing, obviously stock selection, broodstock selection, but the conditions that they're able to vary in the hatchery to simulate different mm-hmm. conditions in different hatcheries allow them to model hatchery... success, I guess, over a wide range of conditions.
I know I have ODFW here that can answer it, but I wanted to hear from your perspective what...
CCA supports the best available science right now. I know there's been some studies here the last several years about how to improve our hatchery system, and we support that best available science, whatever that may be.
Okay. And a follow-up is, there has been reports, I'm sure you're pretty familiar with it, that has been done by independent science teams about improving our hatchery system. Do you believe that ODFW is implementing that to the best of their ability? I mean, doing that in a sound way as far as the recommendations? I don't know if you're familiar with, we had a whole panel on that last time, so I don't know if you're familiar with those recommendations and get a sense of your perspective of how those are being implemented.
Chair Dingfelder, I'm pretty familiar with the general principles applied by the Hatchery Salmon Review Group, HSRG is commonly the acronym used. They've taken a look at the tribal hatcheries, the federal hatcheries, the state of Washington hatcheries, and the Oregon hatcheries associated with the Columbia River. It's an extension of a hatchery reform review process that was first started on the Washington coast and in Puget Sound. It's my understanding that they've made recommendations to all the managers and that the most consistent status quo operation with their recommendations are in Oregon, requiring less changes. It's my understanding that Oregon in general agrees with all those recommendations and either has implemented them, is going to implement them. We from the industry strongly support that. There's no question that the science has evolved to where interaction, either genetic or behavioral interaction between hatchery fish and wild fish, where they're overlapping, can be detrimental to wild fish. There's no question about it. And one thing that's still one to study is exactly what the mechanism of that is, whether that's genetics or behavior or some triggering between the two. But in general, Oregon has had for a very long time a strategy which essentially tries to separate the hatchery fish and wild fish geographically, have the hatchery fish and wild fish move through the main stem in such a way that they contribute to fisheries, and then peel the hatchery fish off, either at weirs or through selective fisheries or through imprinting and targeting them back at the hatchery. It's very clear that if you swamp out wild fish populations with the hatchery fish on the spawning grounds, there's going to be detrimental impacts. There's no question about that. The science is clear about that. The strategy comes into how do you do that. For over 20 years, we've had hatchery reform on the Oregon coast where we actually set whole rivers aside as wild fish reserves for various species, some for all species, and essentially concentrated our hatchery production in other rivers where we were able to accept some trade-off impacts. And the same general geographic separation strategy, selective fishery strategy, mass marking strategy, that's the foundation of the HSRG recommendations, has been a foundation of Oregon's fish management on the coast and in the Columbia for a number of years.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. We actually are out of time, but appreciate you coming here today, and we'll continue getting some more information from ODFMW. I think we've asked them to provide us some additional information on meeting those recommendations. So thank you very much for being here today. And last but not least, we have, I think I saw Phil Ward hiding in the back there. We have Director Ward from the Water Resources Department. Let's talk about our last issue today, which is municipal and quasi-municipal water rights. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. Happy to be with you here at 4:30 on Monday evening to talk about municipal and quasi-municipal water rights. Quasi-municipal water rights are rights that look a lot like municipal, only they're privately held, not public. Not a public company like a municipal right. So, as I understand it, my charge today is to talk a little bit about our processes for granting these rights, and then I understand there may be some questions surrounding that issue, and I'll be happy to attempt to answer those. There are essentially three processes for getting a water right in the state of Oregon. One of them is the process related to small reservoirs, and others the process for utilizing stored water, and the third is what we call our regular process, and that is the process that municipal and quasi-municipal water right applicants utilize. So it's a standard process that these applicants and all other individual water right folks that are looking for a new water right utilize. When an application by a municipal applicant or quasi-municipal applicant is filed with the department, we perform a what we call an initial review. It's a preliminary look at whether we think that right will go forward. And then at the conclusion of that review, we provide an opportunity for public comment. And we also provide the results of that review to the Departments of Environmental Quality and Fish and Wildlife, because they often have comments to make on water right applications with the agency. And what they say can impact whether an application moves forward or at what level it might. After the comment period relative to this issue, we prepare what we call a proposed final order. And for a proposed final order to go out the door, the statutes require that the department presume several things. One, that surface water, that the use will not impair or be detrimental to the public interest. And if four criteria are satisfied, we can make that determination. The first criteria is that the use is consistent with our applicable basin program. The state's divided into water basins, and they all have different requirements in them, and so we have to ensure that the use is consistent with that program. Two, whether that water is available. And the proposed use, number three, will not injure other water rights. And then four, the proposed use would comply with other rules of the Water Resources Commission. And there are some specific and kind of critical rules here that are in place to protect sensitive, threatened, and endangered fish species. and rules that require the department to make a positive finding requiring the compatibility of the proposed use with applicable local land use plans. And then finally, there's a rule that requires that we make a finding as to the amount of water necessary for the proposed use. That proposed final order, if it goes out the door, triggers a 45-day protest filing period. So folks who disagree with that proposed order can then once again enter the process formally as a protestant. If no protests are received, the department can move forward. But if they are received, we have to work through those protests. Interestingly, this process is statutorily designed to take 8 months. It can stretch into years, literally, if there's a protest of the water right application. So just concluding quickly this testimony, and then again, I'm happy to answer any questions. The water right application process for municipalities and quasi-municipal entities can be complicated. It is time-consuming, but it does have a number of checks and balances that the intent of which are to ensure that both the resource is protected as are senior water right holders. And again, as I mentioned, there are two formal opportunities to become involved in that process by either commenting or filing a protest. So, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to respond to any questions with that brief overview of the process. Thank you.
I have one, and then I think there's going to be some other questions here. How do you tell me quasi-municipal? How is that defined? That in rule, statute? We were just looking up in statute.
Quasi-municipal is actually defined in rules. I didn't bring a copy of the rule with me today, but that it is formally defined in our rules. Yes, ma'am. And I can provide that.
Yes, because that's a question I had. So we'll take a look at that.
Would that be like a brewery?
Senator?
Yeah, thank you. I want to thank the chair for allowing this topic to be put on the agenda for today. And I have told the director that we're not here to ask him about a specific situation, but I'll put the framework. There is a quasi-judicial municipality that was looking, or still is in the process of trying to get a water right off the McKenzie River, and move water from there into an area that may be, my guesstimation, 10 to 15 miles away from there for potential use in the future. And because of that, I've had a number of constituents who've asked how this process works, and I wanted to get something in the framework of getting something on the record, and I appreciate, Phil, you being here to do that. My understanding is that that there is a proposed order that has been released, and that's there. I don't want to go into the details on the litigation part because we're not sure where it's all going to end up, and understanding that your office still has a decision to make before we have something come out that's final, at least out. So, but at the same time, I think it's also important for us to be looking at what our needs are and how the agency looks regionally across the boards as to what might be necessary in the future that you can't really demonstrate today, right now, you need that water. So a junior water right applicant could potentially somehow maybe get an edge or an interest into that may be for the common good, better reserved for future distribution, and that we don't see where that would somehow impair that. And I know in my discussions with the director and my discussions with EWEB, Eugene Water Electric Board, that there is some discussion and some talk that's been ongoing about looking at regional perspectives of making certain that we have the capability of getting water into these areas that you already have a established use, more than likely than not municipal established use, and that we're not going to see somehow those things being undercut. So I don't know if you want to kind of give us an abstract on this as to what we could be potentially looking for in the future, because my goal here, Madam Chair, is for making certain that we're planning for the future, mm-hmm. and not necessarily a year or two, but decades down the road, and knowing that, as we've heard from the last presentation, how many people were expecting to be in Oregon by the turn of the century. And to me, this is the time for us to be planning for whatever needs are necessary
another 50-plus years.
So, Madam Chair, if I might, Senator, just a couple thoughts there. It's interestingly that the department doesn't really, under Oregon law, have a tool to incent the kind of regionalization you just described in terms of requiring folks or giving incentives for different water providers in areas to work together. Now, we actually had some a little bit of grant money a few years ago that we used to ask a couple areas, one of them was the North Coast, to take a look at regionalizing water supply up there because there were real water short areas and areas with water that potentially could be shared. And they did go forward and did a nice analysis of the potential opportunities of regionalization, but nothing has moved forward since that time. In some ways, Senator, it reminds me of the consolidation of rural school districts. And any of us that have lived through one of those in any time of our professional or personal past will remember the angst that usually accompanies that that type of activity. So I think the department has felt for some time, and indeed the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, which we are hopeful our commission adopts this coming August, actually articulates a desire to move forward a discussion about some regionalization of water providers. So that needs to be a part of the equation as we kind of balance forward how we ensure that we're meeting Oregon's water needs in the most effective and efficient way in the years ahead. And certainly when we have private quasi-municipal, so private providers that serve a group of people, they can come forward with a proposal to essentially to do what they think they might be able to get done in terms of finding clients and moving things forward. And if they provide a reasonable justification for how that might work, then our rules allow that to move forward. Our rules and the statutes allow that to move forward. But the safeguard is that they have to prove up. For that permit to actually happen, they have to prove up and put ultimately that water to beneficial use. And so a quasi-municipal permit holder has 5 years to prove up on that permit. Now they can ask for an extension if they don't get it done in 5 years, but ultimately they have to prove up on that permit or the amount of water they're given is dialed back to reflect what they've actually been able to prove up on, or the permit is disallowed altogether if they're not able to put water to beneficial use. That's the current safeguard we have in Oregon law, and to be frank, it's often exercised, and there are times when folks do not, are not able to prove up on their right, and that permit is dialed back significantly to reflect that. That's the current safeguard that's there, but I wouldn't discount it at all. The need to have a concerted look at ensuring that we have a coordinated and regional approach to water supply. We think that's important, and indeed the Integrated Water Resources Strategy articulates that.
Follow-up?
I have a couple things, but I'm fine for now.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Director Ward, I will make a comment for somebody who's worked on this for many, many years, including I sat for several years on the Portland Water Provider Consortium. We certainly struggle with that because Western water law, the way it's constructed, does not incentivize conservation or collaboration. Just put it that way. And that's one of the reasons that the Integrated Water Resources Strategy came about, is to look at better ways to integrate and look at potential incentives. And I just made myself a note that we have to make sure that, I know that's part of the integrated strategy, but making sure it's a major part, because we do not have incentives in place right now for municipalities to share resources, and what I see oftentimes is municipality says, we don't want to rely on municipality X, so we're going to go ahead and do our own, and it isn't always necessarily the most cost-effective or the most efficient method of providing needed water. And then also, as you just talked about in this instance, it doesn't promote a holistic view for looking at the watershed and making sure that all the needs in the watershed are being met. So I think there's definitely ways that we can prove it. Certainly, I will be looking at our statutory framework to see if there's ways we can make the improvements. I understand you have to work within the confines, your rulemakings in the confines of the statute, but this, my sense is with the increased demand that we're going to be seeing, this is not going to be a unique situation. And so certainly, I know you're in the middle, I'm not going to, as Senator Przanski said, talk about this case, but my sense is we're going to be seeing more and more of these types of applications, and I think we need to think hard about what's the best way to incentivize collaboration, cooperation where we can.
Well, I think the other part of that's the flip side is that those who want to speculate as to potentially getting a corner of part of that market, and understanding that we have a framework of someone has basically 5 years under that scenario to be able to prove it up. I'm wondering whether or not we should be looking at, before they even get the 5 years, what do they have on the table now, as compared to basically saying we want this right because we're going to be able to sell it to various other municipalities that already have their own systems who are not in need of any more additional water. And it seems like, why would we be wanting to put a middle person in between those two from the future use of those municipalities that are already existing with the, let's say, established base of clients, et cetera.
So. And just to follow up on that, I don't think it's in the best interest of the ratepayer who will end up potentially paying more.
Right.
As Senator Przanski was saying, it's, in this particular case, it was sort of a speculative effort. And the concern is that, you know, water is a commodity, and it's going to, as we know, we are facing higher growth in the state with the economy turning around slowly. But certainly we have areas in the state that are in dire need as far as water, and other areas that you know, are in better shape, but certainly certain times of the year we have high needs almost everywhere in the state. So I think if anything, we need to be more mindful of it, and our current system, I think, is somewhat constrained in that regard. So
when was Chinatown filmed?
Was that it's not that long ago, believe me, but that is a warning. So if you haven't read it, please read or see the movie or read Mark Reisner's book, Cadillac Desert. It would be a good one for committee members to read. So I'm sure we'll be having more discussions about this. Thank you for being here today. Okay, with that, Beth, do we have anything else on the docket?
Okay.
Thank you all. We're out just a few minutes early, and we'll see you again soon.
Yeah.